welcome to Beamcast. This is the September 20th edition of the ShonenBeam.com podcast. My name is Jean.
My name is Drew.
My name is Clint.
And we are back in the studio. You can hear our voices crystal clearly. This is fantastic. I can see these guys for once. It's nice to be back.
Reunited.
And it feels so good. We're excited. We hope you're excited to have us back like this, too. Please join us on the Shonen Beam social network. We're on Facebook, on Twitter. We're on my anime list. Pop in, check us out on IRC, Shonen Beam on the Ryzen network. As always, please email the show, shonenbeam@gmail.com. Very briefly, I want to thank you guys. You guys have been fantastic with the comments and the emails lately. Thank you so much for being interactive. Keep that going. Some news briefly. The Fairy Tail anime has had a second season confirmed, which is going to deal largely with the Nirvana story arc. So that's not exactly a major surprise, I don't think, really. I mean, it was fairly well successful. Any surprise to you at all?
Yeah, it seems to have done well enough. I'm not too surprised. It certainly seems to be doing well enough. At least, like, Crunchyroll isn't the best judge of things, but since I've gotten a subscription to it, it definitely seems to have been doing well on there.
Can't say exactly that I'm excited about a second season, as I haven't been watching the anime out of choice.
I haven't watched the anime at all. I just prefer the manga for Fairy Tail.
Yeah.
It's big enough and important enough to me that it seems like it's kind of a surprise that we hadn't heard anything about a second season before this.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, that's a good point. Shonen Jump has announced the Top of the Super Legend lineup feature. It's a bit unusual of a title, but basically for six consecutive issues 45 through 50, quote-unquote legendary creators will be contributing one-shots, which is actually rather interesting. And those creators are Masashi Kishimoto of Naruto, Hideaki Sorachi of Gintama, Takeshi Konomi of The Prince of Tennis, Kyosuke Usuta of Puto Fuku Jaguar, Osamu Akimoto of Kochikame, and Akira Toriyama of Dragon Ball. They will all be doing one-shots that have absolutely nothing to do with their previous series, just brand new things. For example, Kishimoto, we know, is going to be drawing Bench, which is, quote, a hot-blooded baseball manga. I'm actually really rather interested to see what these six creators do. I mean, first of all, it's a very varied cast of creators here. And the fact that, I mean, for people like Akimoto of Kochikame, Usta, who's Gag, and certainly Kishimoto, who's had one really major series, to see what else they could do. I'm absolutely fascinated by this.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting. I'm kind of also interested to see if Toriyama, all of his characters look like Goku still.
Well, spoiler alert,
I am 100% sure they will.
Yeah.
But yeah, I am looking forward to this because I do like, when I'm following Urasawa, for example, I really like to see how the same author's take on different things can come out with the same art style.
Right.
And I'm definitely looking forward to Kishimoto's, especially because she is like the most single-minded in terms of the body, or he is the most single-minded in terms of the body of work he's put out thus far.
Exactly. Although Kochikame, you'd have to say, is probably
also pretty single-minded, but it's been long enough that it's gone basically everywhere.
Exactly. Voice actor Norio Imamura, you may remember a while ago, was in some hot water for posting indecent pictures of himself in the news.
Speaking of stuff that's long enough.
no, please. Got in trouble for posting indecent pictures of himself. His take on the story is that he wanted to show off the fact that he completed his full body tattoo, and that just so happened to involve nudity. He has been fined 500,000 yen for these indecent pictures that were on his blog. And how does that relate to Shonen? Once again, he is best known for playing the voice of Emporio Ivankov in the One Piece TV anime series, which is rather appropriate given the crime, I would suppose.
That is incredibly ironic.
Yeah, most definitely. I guess he didn't have the standard doujin mosaic on his picture when he made it.
City Hunter, long ago famous classic Jump Shonen series, City Hunter is getting a live-action Korean TV series. So I thought, was it last week or the week before that we mentioned that Hayate was getting a live-action Taiwanese series and now City Hunter a Korean live-action?
Yeah.
Weird.
Disturbing trend.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, I don't know if I'd say disturbing. Korea has every right to a show. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I think my plugging StarCraft chat rooms has paid off in that regard. Finally, I got that City Hunter production going.
Yeah. The Oricon rankings for the week of September 6th through the 12th. Very briefly here, number one, Oron High School Host Club, number 17. Number two is Angel Heart, 33. Number three is Nerehyon no Mago, 12. Number four is Hanmabaki Son of Ogre, 25. And number five is Mayoi Neko Overrun, number two. Looking elsewhere at what other shonen is on the list. At number 7 is Sket Dance Volume 15. Madaka Box number 6 has dropped down to number 12. Siren number 13 is down at 15. One Piece 59 is still on the list. Total sales are now over 2.4 million for that volume. Kochikame is on there, Saint Seiya, Detective Conan, etc. FMA is down there in 29th. Not a big shonen release week, at least. It's just hangers-on from previous weeks, so we'll move on from that. Release dates for this upcoming week. We have DVD number 32 of Bleach for $24.92. However, this is entirely filler, and literally all four episodes on this disc are filler. So it's certainly not as though we were recommending Bleach wholeheartedly beforehand, but Bleach filler, even worse than Bleach?
Yeah.
Pretty much. And plus, it's like, what, $6 per episode of filler for Bleach?
Yeah.
Dot, dot, dot.
Steer clear. Manga-wise, Volume 13 of Blackjack will be out. $16.95 for that one. Classic Dark Doctor series. The best doctor ever. Worth a pickup. Weekly poll results. Let me bring up our results from the previous week here. Once again, we are recording the show earlier than our usual schedule dictates, so I can just give you what we have right now, but I will leave the poll results. I will leave the poll open until this is posted. But as of right now, for the poll, which of these shonen genres do you enjoy out of action, comedy, mystery, romance, and sports? The clear winner here is action, with about 32% of the vote. Currently, there is a tie between comedy and mystery for second place. They both have about 22% of the vote. Following that is sports with about 13%, and bringing up the rear, as we probably rather expected, is romance with about 10% of the votes. Is that kind of how we expected it to play out?
Yeah, I kind of foresaw romance going at the bottom, because I think shonen as a whole is, like, weaker as a demographic for romance. Not to say that there aren't some good romances in shonen, just that it, in general, turns out a specific type of romance which doesn't appeal to as many people.
Right.
But you know, again, we mentioned this earlier a little bit. It's like, our poll kind of turned out like the standard grading curve of manga. It's like, you expect adventure to be at the top, and then you've got comedy and mystery kind of a little bit beneath that, filling out a good chunk. And then at the bottom, you kind of have sports and romance.
Right. Again, we'll leave that open until Monday when the new show is posted here. So we'll see how that changes, and I'll post the results with the show, so we'll check that out later. But now it is time to move on to the Great Shonen tier list. We are going to begin by fulfilling a request we had a couple weeks ago, a multi-part request. We began fulfilling that last week by tiering Father, and let us begin this week by tiering Boa Hancock of One Piece. And Boa Hancock's powers have presented a very unusual scenario for us. I mean, she's so uniquely very tiebreaker centric, I would say, for the purposes of our tier list, in a lot of points. Her power, if you're not already aware, is the Mero Mero no Mi. Basically, she can use anyone's lust or love of her beauty, to turn them into stone, using an actual devil fruit power that she has. That is not her only attack. She also has use of haki, so she can imbue her, she blows kisses that are imbued with haki. So she has haki projectiles in the forms of, like, bullets and arrows. But probably the most notable thing that people are aware of with Boa Hancock is that ability to petrify anyone who loves her, anyone who lusts after her. So it's a really bizarre power because, I mean, canonically, for example, Luffy is immune to it because he's just the oblivious type who isn't really concerned with romance. And surely that's a character type that plays out in a lot of different series, but, you know, who's to say that Natsu, for example, would or would not fall prey to that? So, unusual, but we'll do our best to tier that accordingly. And I want to start by looking in strong tier here. Just let's take a look at kind of the bottom half of strong tier, just as a whole, and look at the types of characters that we're looking at here. On the power alone of her haki projectile ability, which is strong in its own right, what kinds of characters do you see her beating? Do you see her beating most of these characters? Are there any specific examples that jump out at you? What do you think, Clint?
Most of these characters probably get beat on her haki alone without her having to resort to the fruit power that she possesses.
Mm-hmm.
I think everybody, certainly Crocodile and Natsu, are like the zone where, like, haki will probably result in a win, and everybody below that, I think, is the same is true.
Right. Okay, now, let's make sure that we actually have her in the right place. Looking at least like the bottom half of high tier, do you think that haki is going to do too much here, Drew?
I don't think it'll do too much. It might. The one thing it might do is penetrate Zekai, but like even then, Yoshimori has Kekai designed to withstand energy blasts, so I don't think he's got anything on anybody. She has a situational against Kaoru, but nothing really that haki is going to do there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm kind of leaning towards in between that. Looking at the top half of Strong Tier then, first of all, on Haki alone, and Clint, I want to get your thoughts on this. Just on Haki alone, characters like Kisame, Guy, Tsunade, skipping over Luffy because that's a very series-centric issue, Sani perhaps, what do you see playing out here?
I definitely think that Haki alone isn't enough to win these fights, especially dealing with the three Naruto characters there. I definitely feel Haki would not be enough to win in a fight against them.
Okay, but do you think then that her Devil Fruit power would come into play at this point?
I think it would kind of come into play at this point. It would certainly give her a win over Guy at the very least.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. Now, Drew, your thoughts on kind of the same group, the top area of Strong Tier?
Yeah, I think we're definitely looking at, like, it gives her a victory over Guy. I don't think Haki itself will be sufficient. I think, like, it's shown to not just work on guys, but work on females as well. I think there's a chance it could affect Tsunade. It can't be counted out quite. Mm-hmm. And, like, otherwise I would give Tsunade a slight edge in that if, like, the Mero Mero no Mi doesn't affect her. But she does seem to be bound by quite a few earthly desires, so that's a possibility. And then Sani has, like, a very strong like for all beautiful things. And
right.
I think that would be a natural. He would fall for her.
Yeah, and obviously Luffy would not fall. I mean, that is completely series-centric tiebreaker issue. So we're going to kind of take him out of the picture for now. Regarding her Devil Fruit power, I just don't really see it affecting too many people at the bottom of high tier. I mean, situationally, it can work on some of the characters at the top of the high tier and above even, but I'm not willing to move her that far up the list based on her victories over individual characters at different points throughout the upper echelons of our tier list. So I'm kind of looking above Sani at the new top of our strong tier based on the blend of powers that she has. Does that sound about reasonable to you guys?
Yeah, that seems about right.
Okay. Yeah. Drew, any
to me,
objection?
Seems about right. Like, I've been looking at high tier in terms of, like, physical attacks won't work on them. I feel Boa could still be taken out with physical things.
Mm-hmm. That seems about right to me. It is a really unusual power to tier, and certainly, you know, listeners, if you have any diverging opinions on this, please let us know, shonenbeam@gmail.com. But for now, we will be placing Boa Hancock at the top of the strong tier, and we will now move to Konan from Naruto, who has had some spotlight in recent chapters, and let's begin by moving up the list a little bit here. Let's take a look at the top half of high tier.
Well, we have to, since she can make rainbows.
Of course.
Yeah. Pardon me. I completely neglected that. Let's look at the top half of top tier. No, really, the top half of high tier, which we didn't get a chance to look at just now with Hancock. Looking at all the different Bleach characters here, you know, Kuwabara of Vash the Stampede, Yoshina Ageha from Siren, Konan's power is control over paper, and she's rather similar to a Logia from One Piece in a way. It's not instantaneous, it's not subconscious, but she does have a technique where she actually can deconstruct herself completely into paper. So she has far superior defensive abilities than a lot of these characters that are around here. Your thoughts on Konan versus those upper high-tier Bleach characters?
I really think, like, she does have an edge in being able to turn herself to paper, but will she be able to get the technique off before characters with this level of Bleach speed can cut her?
I think for the upper level, like, for the elite tier Bleach characters, that might be true. My personal opinion would be that, like, for Renji and Rukia's level of speed, she would be able to form the hand seal necessary, and she's done it fairly quickly. She'd be able to form the hand seal necessary enough to, I guess, spread herself to paper before Renji and Rukia got in the cutting blow.
Right. I mean, the hand seal that we actually see her use, we did go back and look at this, it wasn't one of those, like, complicated 10 consecutive different hand positionings. It was, if I recall correctly, it was one hand seal.
It's the same sign they used for the Genjutsu release.
Right. So that's rather quick.
Yeah.
And certainly that's not as though it's her only attack or defense. So I tend to agree with you on that one. I think we're looking a little bit higher here. But how much higher? Compare her to the other Naruto characters that are in elite tier. We have, you know, looking up the list, we have the fourth Hokage, Namikaze Minato, we have Itachi, Sasuke, Naruto, and then looking down at the bottom of that tier, we have Jiraiya and Orochimaru. Drew, which end of the elite tier do you think we should start at here?
I'm looking from the bottom. I don't think she's going to be able to beat Itachi or maybe even Sasuke.
Okay, but she did seriously harm. Granted, he wasn't exactly entering the fight seriously, but she did seriously harm Madara.
But at the same time, like, the technique she used there was very situationally set up. She had the whole ocean of paper set up beforehand.
Right. Okay, that's a good point. So would you be inclined to say that within the series, she is stronger than Jiraiya and or Orochimaru?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I mean, blowing off Madara's arm was completely under her own accord. It was before she opened up the sea of paper on him. I think that's something that's relevant. And no one had hurt him in the series previously, so props to her on that.
She also seemed to be able to really compete with Jiraiya when she first showed up in the series, and that's something not a lot of people had done before then.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, in relation then to Sasuke and Naruto, what do you think about those matchups?
I think that with Sasuke, you have, like, the she's instantly on fire thing, but at the same time you also have a lot of other techniques that he could maybe use to attack all the paper together.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not Amaterasu, because that is just a fire attack and her paper has been shown to be immune to fire, but I get the feeling that Sasuke with his like own level of technique and chakra would be able to do something about that.
Yeah, I kind of get that same feeling. What about Naruto specifically, Clint?
I think Naruto just has the kind of huge scale level attacks that she can't use without having, like, an ocean of paper in preparation. He can just pull those attacks out anywhere with no preparation.
Right, so somewhere in between Naruto and Jiraiya, then. Right in the middle, we have a few different elemental users right there. We have Ace, Frederica, and Hitsugaya. Again, fire was shown not to be effective. I think it ended up being, what, oil that it was susceptible to, if I recall correctly? But anyway, it was not fire. Fire doesn't really have any effect on her paper. Would she go on top of this little trio here of the elemental users?
Yeah, I would think so. I don't think any of them can seriously do anything to wound her. I don't think any of them can act quick enough before she can turn herself into paper and thus make herself invulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think once she becomes paper, she's got a whole ton of attacks she can use, and none of them really have the juice to take her out then.
Okay, what about Yusuke? Yusuke, demon form, got tons of resistance, tons of durability, beam spam like crazy, even physical strength were it to come down to that. Do you think that at that point it's just overwhelming? I mean, even if she scatters into paper, he can kind of just jump. It's almost like flying, you know, the heights to which he can jump, so he can be far enough away to be able to target pretty much everything with just tons of this beam spam. Do you think that that would be enough to take her out?
Yeah, I think he just jumps, beam spams the ground, and that takes her out before she can get really spread out.
Clint, do you agree?
Yeah, I think this is where she finds her ceiling.
Okay, all right with that. Konan, right below Urameshi Yusuke. Kagura from Gintama, who we've been kind of neglecting for a while now. Sorry, Gintama fans. We're going to look, unfortunately, a little bit down the list, but not too far down the list. Let's take a look in the fair tier to begin with, and let's look at Kagura in relation to kind of just the bottom half of fair tier, which is kind of humans, Chopper aside, of course. Mostly humans here.
He ate the human fruit, don't forget.
He is technically human in a way, in his own way. Shut up, you bastard. mostly humans who are at the peak of human ability, really. Or, you know, some enhanced, some modified, etc. Versus Kagura, who, you know, for those who are not familiar with the series, she is not human. She's, you know, she looks, for all intents and purposes, like a human, but she is of a different race, which is stronger and faster and far more durable. And I think, I mean, really, her strength is the aspect of her that is always emphasized the most out of all of her different traits. To me, that seems to indicate, Drew, that she would be able to beat at least the bottom half of fair tier. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I feel like she'd be above the bottom half of fair tier just on, like, raw strength.
Mm-hmm.
She also, like, if she needs it, she has the projectile umbrella that she has, like, that shoots bullets. But I don't think she even needs it to beat most of these guys, certainly before Kenshin.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. So then taking a look at the top half of fair tier, the very top of fair tier, for all her strength, I'm not exactly sure that she has exactly the same level of strength that a Ranma has because of just how, I mean, he again is one of those characters that benefits from being in a primarily gag series, primarily comedy series. So his strength is just absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah,
his speed, similarly.
Yeah, they're both looking at comedy protagonist level strength. I think Ranma has been shown to take, like, take and give boulder destroying, like tunnel digging punches. I would tend to give the edge to him based on what I've seen.
Ganta versus Kagura. I know you do not read Gintama, but just Ganta, supersonic blood bullets. Do you think he has the edge in this one?
Yeah, I mean, she's not. It doesn't sound like she's fast enough to dodge a supersonic bullet, and it also doesn't seem like she's durable enough to take a hit that can wreck through multiple steel doors and walls.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. Zoro of One Piece versus Kagura. She is of a different race than human, but Zoro is not exactly your cookie cutter human in terms of strength, durability. I'm kind of thinking that he has a rough equivalent to what she has, and then he also has master proficiency over his weaponry, better and up close.
He has weapons, which I think is a factor here when you're looking at the level of superhuman strength that really both have.
Mm-hmm.
Kagero not being human, but still having like a superhuman level.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Zoro, just in terms of having weaponry and being extremely proficient with it, I think that's a huge advantage in a close range fight.
Now, what about Lucy from Fairy Tail?
I think beyond just like having an umbrella that shoots bullets, which I feel Lucy would be susceptible to, I feel like just raw toughness would take out most, if not all, of the summons.
Right. Frankly, I think that Kagura closes down and just takes her out in one hit before she even has the chance to summon anything, frankly. I mean, she is not supersonically quick or anything like that, but she is fast and certainly more than strong enough to take her out in one hit.
I can see that assumption. I'm not so sure she would close quite that fast, but I think she would definitely be able to take Lucy out before she got a summon off regardless.
Okay, so Kagura will go below Zoro and above Lucy. I'm going to introduce a new character from a series that we began covering recently from Codebreaker. It's our protagonist, Ogami Rei. And he's kind of a stripped-down version of, let's say, an Ace. He's not a Logia user at all, by any stretch of the imagination, but he does produce fire. He produces the Azure Flame, which is, let's just say it's supernatural fire. It's not, we've mentioned before that Frederica uses psychic ability to create real fire. This is a little bit more magical fire than that, but it is basically fire that comes from his arm, and he is able to target anything around him, including area of effect damage. He can just spew fire out almost instantaneously and burn his opponents to ashes, really. So on that kind of a power alone, he himself is still rather human. It's a human with an ability rather than someone who is constituted entirely of magic or supernatural power. So I'm still looking fair tier, mid tier level. Beginning by looking at the bottom half of mid tier, you have characters like Toriko, Ikki, Asuna, Sakura. Based on that description of the character, Clint, your thoughts on those types of characters versus someone who has control over a great power but is still innately a human?
I think these are characters that are far and away a little more than human. I mean, we're told that Toriko's a human, and we're told that Sakura's a human, but in my daily life, I don't regularly see humans going around making great craters or firing invisible knives off with their hands.
My apologies, you lead a boring life.
Yeah, I only see those every Tuesday. But yeah, I think that most of these, though they might be hit by his technique, they're also the type of people who would kill him in one punch.
Right, that makes sense to me. So looking then at the... Let's look again at the top half of fair tier, and in fact the top few names here, like Ranma, Ganta, Zoro, Kagura. Ranma specifically, Drew, your thoughts on Ranma versus this type of an ability?
My thoughts on Ranma? I think Ranma has certainly a degree of superhuman ridiculous strength, but I still think he is a human on the grand scheme of things, and he's not going to survive being just lit on fire on the scale of this power.
Mm-hmm. Given that kind of a supernatural ability, perhaps we ought to look at the bottom few characters of mid-tier then. Looking at Miroku, would the black hole suck up all the flames, do you think?
Yeah, Miroku is kind of a natural counter to this.
Right. Ed, again, has the versatility to be able to defend himself with, you know, he can just alchemize the earth to come around him and protect him from it. Ray wouldn't stand much of a chance against him. What about Chad? Chad from Bleach.
I get the feeling Chad is a durable character in addition to having the beam punch that he gets off very quickly. I feel like Chad can endure the flames long enough to get off a beam, and I get the feeling that'll be the end of it.
Okay. So then that would place him right below Chad and above Ranma. But the question then is, does he go in mid-tier or does he go in fair tier? Is he the bottom of mid or the top of fair? Clint?
I would go with the bottom of mid because of the supernatural nature of his power and the beyond human type of deal that power represents.
Okay, and Drew, do you agree?
Yeah, I would say so.
Okay, and then I agree as well. Ogami Rei of Codebreaker is the new bottom of the mid-tier. Moving on to Seiichiro Sano from Law of Ueki, which is a drastically underappreciated series. If you had not yet read it, please go read it. But we are going to spoil a little bit of it for you. His ability, Drew.
His ability is to turn towels into iron, and he can turn them into iron or back at will. And the condition is that he has to hold his breath nominally, but that isn't really shown much and isn't really taken into account in his fights. He uses this for a variety of things. He uses them as springs to jump on, as body armor, as boomerangs that cut things. And most significantly, he also has the ability to turn them into super magnets and deflect swords and bullets that are headed his way.
Okay, so on that set of powers then, it is once again a character with an ability rather than someone who is defined by their own innate superhumanness or magical power. So are we looking kind of the same range as Rei here?
Yeah, I think we are looking. It's reasonable to say he would go near Rei.
Okay, so let's look at the same characters that we just tiered Rei against then. What about Ranma?
Ranma? I get the feeling Sano has a lot more abilities in terms of, like, his superhuman jumping ability via the springs, and then he has projectile attacks, which Ranma doesn't. I feel his body armor would block at least most of Ranma's strong punches.
Mm-hmm. Then the bottom of mid-tier, before we get to Rei, let's look at Chad once again. Your thoughts on Chad, I know that you're not innately familiar with the series, but thoughts on these power sets?
I just think that the beam is a little too much for a Sano-type character. I don't think body armor can completely protect him from something as all-encompassing as a beam.
How strong and thick are those towels, Drew?
Not strong enough. They're towel width.
Oh, okay.
I think Chad could, like, punch through inches of steel anyway.
They're Queen's towels. They're the Queen's standard. All right, so then we just put down Ogami Rei. Your thoughts on that matchup?
Yeah, I think as, like, strong and durable as Sano is, he's, like, gotten burn wounds and they've remained as lifelong scars, so.
Okay, yeah, actually, come to think of it, very situationally, either way, he's kind of screwed. If they're towels, they burn. If they're iron, it burns through that to him.
Yeah, if they're iron, like, the body armor's not going to do anything. He's just going to get caught on fire and burn right away.
Right. So that poses exactly the same question as last time. Is he the new bottom of mid-tier, or is he the new top of fair tier?
It feels more physical and regular human, so I would tend to put him in fair tier.
I tend to think the same. And what about you, Clint?
I agree.
Okay. That puts Seiichiro Sano of Law of Ueki above Ranma at the top of fair tier. And finally this week, we're going to look at Kazu from Air Gear, because we could always use some more Air Gear characters, of course. His ability, he's actually canonically faster than Iki, at least as of right now. He has legitimate canonical supersonic speed. He has a very interesting ability, which the name of the ability evokes the word time, but he does not actually have manipulation of the flow of time. That's just the way that this, if you understand, oh great, hats off to you.
You're one of the select few.
Yeah, exactly. But basically, to summarize one of his abilities, he has the ability to strike his opponent's joints in such a way that it appears as though he has slowed down time, because he's striking the opponent's joints to either slow down their movement or paralyze them. And he can use this either offensively, just, you know, use his supersonic speed to close the distance and strike his opponent's joints and paralyze them. Or if his opponent is striking at him, he can, as they are striking, strike a joint that is, you know, if they're punching, he can strike their elbow, for example. And it will slow down their attack. So that's why he uses the word time, because it kind of, you could interpret it in a way that he's bending time, sort of, if you smoke whatever O'Grade is smoking. So, basically, the number one asset that Kazu has going for him is supersonic speed. Frankly, on that alone, I am willing to say, and if you disagree, please write in, but I'm willing to say that on that alone, he goes above Iki. There have been some hints to the fact that he might be better than Iki in the series right now anyway, but if we are detaching characters' abilities from their series-centric rankings regardless. I think that just this legitimate supersonic speed at least puts him above Iki, but I'm not sure how much higher, so I'm still going to look in mid-tier. And guys, I want your thoughts. Before we get into all the crazy, you know, the time-bending and whatnot, I mean, supersonic speed, are we looking at the top of mid-tier now, at least?
Yeah, I think we're looking higher. Like, that's pretty much as high speed tier gets without stopping time. I think the real question is how much offense he has.
Mm-hmm. And again, I mean, the issue with air gear characters, and frankly, the issue with air gear, is that Ogreat is very, very keen on reminding you that he is a great artist. For all his faults, he actually is a rather good artist. And all of the attacks are visually represented by something completely different. For example, when Akito slash Agito attacks someone, it is represented by a giant shark eating a fish or something. But you don't actually see what's happening to represent that attack. So it is left to us to surmise that these characters, Kazu included, are using some form of basic martial arts slash street fighting, brawling. Basically, we're assuming that Kazu in all of this would use supersonic speed to close the distance and kick at joints. And you know, supersonic speed is all well and good, but ultimately, is a character like, say, Toriko going to be taken down by just joint kicking? Your thoughts?
It's tricky to say. I feel like Toriko would have less of a way to hit him. I still kind of think that, like, if he's going to be able to punch at the joints with truly supersonic speed, I think it's faster than Toriko can handle. I think eventually enough hits at the joints where the least muscle gathers on the human body would still like be able to hit Toriko, if not right away.
Right. And that is, I mean, ultimately that is the benefit because, it, you know, his supersonic speed is attack and defense because he can just continually run away, strike, run away, strike, run away. So, yeah, he's not going to be taking very much damage from this. So let's look up at the top area of mid-tier then. Another fast character or two here. We got Kagero and we have Suna right up at the top, right below Kazuma. I'm of the opinion that he would be able to beat Suna if only on speed alone. Suna has one major area of attack blast, basically, but it is fairly unidirectional. And surely Kazu could get behind him and attack him. Your thoughts on Kazu versus Kagero, Drew?
It's a tough call for me. I guess I'd have to go for Kazu just because Kagero has his own degree of blinding speed, but it doesn't seem like it's quite supersonic. And although Kagero is offensively superior, I don't think he has a way to catch supersonic speed at the end of the day.
Okay, with that reasoning, would we then be able to also justify placing him above all of the other characters below, Alan Walker, Rekka, Nura, etc.? Are we okay with that, Clint?
Yeah, I mean, Nura is a very situational counter, but looking at every character beneath that, I just don't think they can match the speed that allows him to strike at joints and be defensive and get as many hits in as he needs to finish the fight.
Even characters renowned for speed, such as Rock Lee, I mean, they're unbelievably fast, but I mean, canonical supersonic speed. You can't really hold a candle to that. What about Kazuma? He's currently the top of our mid-tier. Drew, you are the scryed expert amongst us.
Yeah, I kind of think that, first of all, Kazuma does have full body armor, and he's taken a couple of pretty serious joint hits in manga and not really shown anything from it. My gut would be that like Kazuma would take this fight just on endurance and the fact that he can make his fist larger, and he's used that at several times in an area of effect blast to hit a teleporter. So supersonic speed is still below teleportation. I think based on that, I would put the Kazuma from Scryde higher.
Okay.
The Kazuma from Air Gear.
So let's make sure that is not just a situational tiebreaker issue. Is Kazu distinctly below everyone in strong tier, Clint?
Yeah, I feel pretty comfortable in saying that people on the level of Gray, Tommy Rod, Natsu, he's not going to be able to do anything against those kind of people.
Okay, and I am perfectly in agreement with that. So we're going to place Kazu right below Kazuma. Kazu is now second place in the mid-tier. You know, please feel free to send in your requests. We love getting requests for who to do because it saves us the trouble of picking. All right, time to move now to the anime discussion portion of the show, and Drew is going to kick us off with episode 11 of High School of the Dead.
Well, we sort of see the resolution of the, like, evil teacher arc here. We see him pretending to be humble, like, basically having created a bus of lesbians and sex-crazed teenagers. And he just sort of comes up to the mansion where they're staying, like, asks to be let in, succeeds in doing so, and then the Lancer girl gets a little bit mad at her for him having held her back a grade, we find that out. He held her back a grade to put political pressure on her father. And then in the end, we just see her not killing him. And then the last episode is just going to be, like, them hunting down their families. I'm not sure how I feel about how they dealt with the teacher. I think it was at least capable, but Clint, did you think it was at all satisfying the way they did?
No, you really wanted to see him get his comeuppance at this time.
Yeah, I feel like just leaving him be is a bit much. I feel like it was creative to not kill him, and I'm glad they did that, but I think they also let him get off a little too scot-free, considering like what he's done and like the fact that he's been kind of an asshole. Aside from the thing he did to Ray, the one girl, he's been just an asshole in general since the zombies showed up. And then we get to see what's going to happen next episode. The last episode of the series is just going to be them hunting down their families in the middle of an electromagnetic pulse. So I'm not really too hopeful for this series finale. It's been all right as a series, but it hasn't lived up to my expectations, which may have been a bit of high.
Yeah, it had quite a bit of hype behind it right at the beginning, and it was tough for it from that point on.
Yeah. It's like a pretty low-level for a madhouse show, I would say.
Seitokai Yakuin Demo, episode 11.
This episode features them going out to Aria, our Ojo-sama of the group. They go out to her house, her cabin, for a Christmas celebration. And our main character brings his little sister, and the entire student council is there, and Aria's maid is there. And a good time is had by all by gifting dildos and vibrators to our main character.
Especially vibrators. To me, I really like the way they set up the vibrator joke, because it's a triple-tier joke. First one is the maid gets, like, for the gift lottery, she gets a vibrator. Suda hopes he doesn't end up with it, and of course he does. But then he gets, like, a second gift from the student council president, and then it's like, aw, how cute, and then it's a vibrator. And you get to see all of this by the box vibrating. And then Santa shows up, just flying down out of the sky. Santa shows up, tosses him a present, and is like, wow, I wonder what it is. And then box starts buzzing.
Yeah,
I laughed so much.
It was very well set up. The whole scene, they're really focusing in on a relationship between our main character and the student council president.
Yeah, I do kind of like that. I think it's the appropriate amount of romance for like a comedy series like this one.
Yeah, it's certainly a lot more.
I think it's setting it up for an ending pretty nicely.
It's a lot more romance than they would normally do. It's normally it would be kept very ambiguous, but they've very, very endearingly paired the characters up.
And I think this is about, again, the right level. I think it's a little cute, but not overwhelming the fact that it is a gag series.
Right.
Legend of the Legendary Heroes, episode 12.
Well, here we see Miron slaughtering off a whole bunch of nobles, completely disregarding Xion's offer for a purge. And then, actually, the one noble Miron was conspiring with the whole time is then killed off by another agent from another country, which is revealed at the end of the day to be Gastark, the country Xion alluded to last episode while cajoling people into accepting their own promotions. So this is sort of very neatly tying up the plot, setting up the people from Gastark as a final boss. And we've also seen that, like, the people that Reiner and Ferris fought in episode 10 were also from Gastark, so that pretty much sets them up as a country of pink-haired bishies for the final boss. Very nice.
Yeah.
Not very nice, actually. That's kind of a disappointment. That said, the scenes between Reiner and Arua were funny and were a little bit interesting and insightful into his character, so it was a decent episode overall. Just a bit of a lame plot twist.
Episode 11 of Nurarihyo no Mago dealt largely with Keikai Yura and her eventual fight with the unnamed. We got a name. It was Muchi, I think it was, for the main villain of this little.
Muchi,
yeah. I believe that was his name. Whip.
Yeah.
Basically, it's just we're getting a little bit more expansion on these demons, these yokai that have come in from presumably a neighboring town, the wind using demons, and they're just setting up buildings. We get a lot of really shady kind of just backstory that we don't really understand anything about. Little side stories, I suppose I should say. Introducing these characters that we don't know too much about, and eventually they start just attacking Nurarihyon himself, the elder Nurarihyon, and Keikai Nyura is there to protect him. And we get to see a rather stunning display of power for, you know, such a young Onmyoji, really. She's controlling, I think, ultimately four Shikigami at once, if I recall correctly. What did you take away from this episode?
they did a lot of building. I think they're mainly trying to establish Yura as a character who is not just a normal on Miyoji. She's definitely more talented than normal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, to me, what I took away from this episode was definitely they did a good job of building up the relationship between Nurarihan and Yura.
Yeah.
How they're talking about yokai before, like, the Muchi show up, and then it was funny to see Nato Kozo hiding in the bag the whole time, providing narration about it. And, yeah, just Nurarihan developing a relationship with someone who's aiming for his life, but he's obviously not worried because he's still several tiers above her in power.
Yeah, clearly.
Presumably.
Clearly. I thought it really enjoyable to see this action animated. I thought it was rather impressive to see the fight itself. So far, I've enjoyed this adaptation of Mago, but I haven't really been blown away. It's been really fun as a week-to-week watch, but I mean, I always forget to get it until it's time to put together the show notes. I have to go rush and watch it quickly. Nothing has really drawn me in too heavily. This fight, I thought, was maybe not, you know, mind-blowing or groundbreaking necessarily, but the quality of the animation was rather good. The situational fighting was rather good. The combative powers, I thought, was really interesting.
Yeah, I thought it was well done for the most part. I mean, originally when the series first aired, I had a few concerns about the quality of the animation, maybe the budget they were working with. But they definitely did completely well through all the action scenes in this episode.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think the action scenes were well enough. They weren't really what stood out to me this episode, but they definitely pulled their own weight.
All right, time now for This Week in Manga, and we're going to begin with a release of Kudanai Chapter 34, which kind of just confused the hell out of me, frankly, for part of it. It's still a rather enjoyable chapter. Basically, this is picked up from where the previous chapter left off, which was the meeting between Kurenai himself and the representative of the Aku Company and Kirihiko-san, Guillotine, the girl he thought he knew, the girl that we thought was just another harem member at this point. And she stabs him, and they kind of challenge each other to this duel of sorts, where Kurenai is initially told to go after a target and kill her. He kind of refuses, basically. She, being Guillotine, takes over, and as he's trying to stop her, she stabs him, but it for some reason doesn't hurt.
She stabs him, and he's just like, wait, I didn't feel anything, so we're presumably led to believe maybe she turned the blade around at the last second or something like that.
Right, because she is, you know, all buddy-buddy with him still, and everything's okay. But regardless, she sets up this conditional competition between them, I guess you could say, where basically she tells him, you know, I'm going to take over this job. I'm going to go and kill this girl. You go protect her, and we'll see who wins. And if you manage to do so, then you don't have to join the Aku Company. Then Kudanai goes home, back to the apartment complex, and he's just walking in, and the strange, you know, the mysterious lady clad in all black, whose name I conveniently forget all the time.
Yamie?
I believe it is Yamie, thank you. So, you know, says, stop right where you are. I have to call a doctor. And Kudanai says something to the effect of, who is it that needs a doctor? And she says, you. And he looks down and sees that spot where he had been cut before all of a sudden is bleeding profusely. Later, we find out that the technique that she used, she again being Guillotine, she cut him, but it didn't do anything at the time. But she's so skilled that she can cut someone, and when they go home and begin to relax, thinking, oh, what a day it's been, then it starts to bleed. That's weird.
A little unbelievable. perhaps not on the level of unbelievability that it clashes with a manga that has, like, large bones coming out of your elbow and increasing the power of your punches.
Yeah, but I don't know, man. This is like, I suspended my disbelief to some extent, but to be able to stab someone in such a fashion that it's like delayed bleeding, that made absolutely no sense to me. But that rather puzzling plot point aside, I thought it was actually a rather enjoyable chapter. The interplay between Kirihiko and Kudanai was rather nice. The surrounding characters were intriguing. Yamie, just once again, in a position where you feel like something has to happen with her rather soon, doesn't it?
She's got to be important. And I mean, what it's done so far is set us up with, it introduces a character, and then we get their backstory at some later on point.
Right.
And we're, by not learning anything about her at this point, we're being built up.
Right. You had brought up an interesting point, which was the safety of the apartments.
No one ever questions the safety of the apartments that they stay in. It's just kind of everyone says, oh, no one will ever threaten these apartments. Something to the effect of they have diplomatic immunity. And you could interpret that as, oh, Juzawa Benika is protecting the place, but she's not there all the time. She's all over the world. So why is it safe all the time?
Exactly.
Presumably it could be something with this woman who we haven't found out anything about.
Yeah, the way that Juzawa Benika kind of drops off Murasaki originally with Shinkuro at that set of apartments, it seems more like I'm aware that this place is safe rather than I'm in control of this place and therefore it is safe.
Not to mention that Benika and Yamie seem to be on like a friendship kind of close talking terms with each other.
Right. Yeah, I'd be very curious to see how that goes. So your thoughts on the chapter overall? I was weirded out by the cut thing, but overall I still thought it was really enjoyable.
Yeah, it was a pretty good chapter, most of all. I'm kind of intrigued to see what the guard, Murasaki's guard, is doing there, guarding the girl that he's now going to be trying to guard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he ultimately did, at the very end of the chapter, I should mention, caught the target who was trying to commit suicide.
Jumped off of a hospital or was pushed off or something, and he immediately asked her if she would like to hire a dispute mediator.
You just tried to kill yourself. Want to hire me? great interview process there. But yeah, good chapter. Going to move on now to the weekly series, and we're going to start with Chapter 510 of Naruto, and as we kind of alluded to in the tier list portion, we'll get some expansion on this fight between Madara and Konan. This is the conclusion of that fight. Just first of all, I want to get your thoughts. We've mentioned in the past few weeks just thoughts on Konan as a character being one of the more interesting females. Frankly, let's even take it out of gender issues here. Just thoughts on her as a character and the different types of abilities that she uses in this fight.
I think paper techniques, they're an interesting road to go down, and certainly it's interesting because they already have existing like paper written on seals and stuff, and she mixes a little bit of that in each fight. It's a shame it didn't get developed on more, actually, but I think we definitely saw reasonable degree of complexity out of her.
Right, yeah, I'd have to agree with that. I think that she's been just a fascinating character full stop, not a fascinating character for a female in Naruto, which admittedly she has been as well.
Yeah, probably, possibly the most fascinating female character and one of the most fascinating characters in the series, bar none.
Right. So ultimately then, this chapter is just about the conclusion, right? It is officially over?
Yeah, I mean, she's been defeated. After putting up a good display, taking Madara's arm, he finally comes out with the spoiler that this fight was ultimately leading us to, that he's collecting all the paths of the sage, and he already has enough to do this technique, Izanagi, where he can basically rewrite reality from whatever illusions he wants to.
He can turn imagination into reality, is I believe the translation that I read.
He's an Imagineer from Disney.
Exactly. So he can exploit childhood dreams for money.
So what do we think about that? Because we've been kind of bemoaning the fact that Madara is just, oh, he's just strong. He's the big bad guy. We know he's a big bad guy. We know he's powerful, but we haven't really understood why. This is kind of the first major reveal as to what kind of power he has at his disposal, and it's rather leaning towards broken.
Yeah, I mean, and he's not even complete yet. I mean, the one thing I liked about this was, well, now we have some sort of goal for him. He wants to gather all six paths of the original sage.
Right.
It's not the Moon's Eye plan, which was ridiculous beyond a shadow of a doubt.
Well, I mean, I imagine that's still in play, but at least that's not all that is in play. What do you think about it?
I think a villain like going around slaughtering people to gain more power certainly is a more villainous thing to do than hunting like things for world peace.
Yeah, by bouncing your laser eye off of the moon.
Off of the moon.
Maybe he just needs another type of laser eye to calibrate the frequencies.
That's the dumbest idea I've ever heard. That's so bad. Anyway, yeah, hopefully he'll continue to be expanded in a positive way. I'm worried. I am admittedly unfairly worried based on the next series that we will be covering as to broken powers and their use and then the way that they are further written. But I want my villains to be realistic, and that's why what I loved in this fight against Konan is that Konan did so well that she blew off his arm, blew off part of his mask, and he's bleeding, he's struggling. He had to resort to something this powerful, but he has something this powerful, so, you know, I reserve my judgment on the character overall, but I'm definitely very pleased with the extent to which Konan was able to push him in this fight.
Yeah, hopefully Konan's confidence will be fulfilled, and Naruto will manage to defeat him by the power of Rainbow Bridges.
How about that rainbow? Yeah. Double rainbow.
all the way across the sky.
Oh my god!
I mean, so maybe beautiful. That's a spoiler for the end. So, well, if you're gonna go out, if you can't make a robot unicorn and throw it at your opponent, next best thing.
Speaking of double rainbow all the way, 420 bleach 420. This is going to be interesting. We've had a lot of comments on this chapter, and thank you very much, first of all, to everyone who did comment. We really appreciate that. This is... you guys talk about this, because I don't even know how to... I'm not ready to say what I'm about to say.
Apparently, we get back to the flashback. Like, I was sort of, like, unclear in the first two pages that we had gone back to a flashback, so it was a little weird to see Zangetsu suddenly showing up. And... he just apparently lets Zangetsu stab him and absorbs Zangetsu into his own power, and now he's no longer a Soul Reaper because he doesn't have a sword, I guess, is what I took out of that.
He is the sword?
The final transformation is becoming Zangetsu.
Well, it says... I'm a little bit confused on that, on exactly the workings of it, because he says it's becoming Getsuga, which is kind of... Getsuga Tensho has been the attack that was used by... Zangetsu. So I'm wondering, is he then the attack, or is he the sword? I mean, I guess it's kind of sort of all the same, but it would be nice to be a little bit more clear about it.
And is it a permanent thing? Like,
Definitely seems to be a permanent thing by the way they're talking about it to me. Like,
meaning that certainly he can't go like Shikai Bankai this. It's just from now on, it'll just be straight to this.
That certainly seems to be why Zangetsu didn't want him to teach it. If it's not, I'd be very surprised to learn what it is. That would seem to me to make the most sense.
The way I interpreted Zangetsu's reluctance to teach him is that it would be damaging because Ichigo didn't feel when Zangetsu was stabbing him. So it's kind of it turns off his like pain awareness.
Mm. That could be one way to think of it. Yeah, I originally didn't read it like that.
Who knows? I could be completely off the mark. That's the way I happened to read
it. We'll see more about this later, I bet. Very quickly.
So our opinions on this, and I'll give you mine, and it's, shocker, I didn't hate this. I certainly didn't love this, I didn't like this explicitly, but I think that for Bleach, considering where Bleach has been, it's actually okay, because Aizen has been developed as this character with a completely broken power. He may not have been written as such in the last few chapters where... the Hogyoku was kind of forgotten about in terms of, like, reality warping. It was more just linear power-up after linear power-up. But ultimately, it was supposed to be able to kind of rewrite plot. So we have a broken villain. We need someone... We need some kind of power-up for Ichigo that isn't just another linear power-up. And that is kind of what this is. This kind of completely supersedes the entire power structure that is in place. I don't love it. The character design is ridiculous. Black on black with black around it. It's just stupid. But... in terms purely of the concept being able to be justified as a way to kill this villain, I'm okay with it. Now, your thoughts on it?
Purely in terms of that, yes. That said, I didn't really enjoy the chapter. I think that, like, this power-up for Ichigo, it's kind of a lame way to do it. It's just another way to apply his sword. Like, I feel like if this is something Ishin knew about and everybody knew about, why hasn't anybody else tried this before? Why did it have to happen in a training arc prior to now? And it just seems like if it's something every Soul Reaper Shinigami can do, like, why now? Why now is he the only person? Why don't they have, like, a squad of people doing this?
I think this is, it's very sword-centric. I mean, we've seen that Ishin's sword very closely resembles Ichigo's. His has the same type of attack. Ichigo's is something to the effect of Moon Fang. And Ishin's was something to the effect of Sun Fang with Getsuga Tensho and then Ishin's attack. What I liked about the power-up was that it follows Ichigo's character progression. His sword was always been told to us as, well, it's not one of those swords that turns into something big and elaborate. It enhances his physical strength and his battle capabilities. And this kind of like wrapping his body in a sort of sword armor and enhancing his abilities that way, it follows a natural progression of power that I'm surprised to see Kubo following through with.
I actually didn't think of that. That's right. Like, if you think about it, his first release enhanced his power, his second release enhanced his speed, and this one just is a big, fat enhancer.
Second release enhanced his swastika.
It's a Manju, like, Hindi symbol, I think.
I'm aware. Yeah. I'm aware it predates the Nazi Party. Thank you very much, historian. I have to say, for a Bleach chapter, it was good. it was not good in the pure detached definition of the word good, but it just basically because this chapter pretty much was entirely the revelation of this concept, because Bleach chapters have so little plot in each one. Because what was the rest of this chapter? It was Aizen getting pissed and Ichigo attacking.
By the way, and the rest of this chapter, the attack was incomprehensible.
Comprehensible as all get out.
Yeah.
I couldn't even tell what was going on. It didn't even look like what was presumably the explosion was within the crater that we were seeing. I had no idea.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's just like a more massive version of his attack, that's one thing. If it just erased everything in that area, that's another thing.
It was called, what, Mugetsu?
Yeah. How I took it, like, what would make the most sense to me about that is if it just was, like, an erasure thing within that area.
That is kind of how I read it, also specifically because of the name. Yeah, I'd be interested to see that. By the way, with regard to knowing how something is a flashback, you gotta follow those backgrounds, man. When the background's all black, that means flashback. Kubo knows
black?
Flash black. Kubo knows his backgrounds, man. The man is a genius. It's either all white or all black.
Or shading between white and black leading into that flashback.
Oh, yeah. But, you know, nice to, you know, finally, a little bit of relief after weeks and weeks of absolute pure torture. This was not a horrendous Bleach chapter.
It Maybe
was
just, next week's chapter will have clouds.
There'll be one tree in the background that was erased. All right. Bakuman, chapter 101. Could you give us the synopsis of the occurrences in this chapter, please?
So basically, this chapter was them finding out why PCP can't be made into an anime, and it was, as the editors had been talking about in the previous chapter, that it's just not suited to being an anime. It's not something... They don't want kids replicating what they see in PCP. They think it's a little too... little too copyable, and parents were complaining and apparently writing letters about how they don't want their kids copying crimes and that sort of thing.
Who knew?
And then at the end of the chapter, they kind of drop a huge bomb in that one of the assistants working for Takagi and Mashiro has a manga that he's been writing, and the editor reviews it, and he says it's great. But how did it get so great? And they find out that Takagi basically did the writing for it. So now Hattori wants Takagi to write for this new series.
The interesting thing that I found about that plot point is that in the pages that preceded it, that a lot of the focus of this chapter, in my opinion, was on the relationship between Ashiro Yumito, between Mashiro and Takagi, because... at the beginning, when they were talking about the necessity of what they made being turned into an anime, Takagi is just really passionately fighting for this thing to be made into an anime, and Hattori is wondering, why are you guys so concerned about an anime? You guys have a very successful manga. Well, that's part of our dream, and he's obviously saying this with the slant of, that's part of our dream, our including Azuki, because I need Mashiro to get this anime made so that he can marry Azuki. And I especially liked, first of all, how that did not create a rift. You know, a lot of times in similar scenarios to this in different manga series where you have, like, a group or a pairing or something succeed overall at a lot of their goals, but, like, maybe one of them hasn't, you know, fulfilled everything, he's not quite as satisfied, you might see a rift appear. This almost served to solidify their relationship, really. So in all of this, Azuki got to thinking, you know, Mashiro got to thinking, you know, how late is too late to get married? He's wondering how long it's going to take. And then he's thinking, well, he's kind of starting to toy with the idea of kind of going out on his own and finding someone else to work with. And if that would fulfill the dream, and if then that would be turned into an anime. And then the tables are turned, and that exact scenario presents itself with Takagi. So it's just... maybe unsettling, maybe, is the word. I'm not exactly sure how to feel about this chapter, because... it just brings about plot points that I never knew could be coming out here, and it's just kind of uncomfortable almost.
Yeah, I think even though we're seeing the two so strongly united with their manga, I really feel like Mashiro was incredibly uncomfortable at the end of this chapter. He had a look of just shock, and like he had considered working on other things, but he hadn't considered Takagi just being the one out there and being...
right,
being involved in with someone else, writing for another manga.
Yeah, it wasn't a bad chapter by any means, but was it a good chapter? I don't know.
Yeah, I'm so torn on it because the events are just like, it seemed like we were so close to an end and now it doesn't.
And let's not say it's not as though we wanted the series to end.
Right.
It's just that from the very beginning, there's been a very clear goal of and a very clear outline of how this series was supposed to play out, and everything so far has been kind of following that formula. Not to say it's necessarily been predictable, but it's been enjoyable and stable and following this path to an extent. And now all of a sudden, for this to come up out of nowhere, you brought up an interesting point that it does kind of once again follow the progression of Oba and Obata's own professional lives.
Yeah, I mean, they kind of split up and did their own things. Before and after Death Note, they both worked on separate projects. So it's more meta to that extent.
Was the chapter more good than bad, at least?
I think that's true of almost any Bakuman chapter. I mean, the plot of the chapter itself would have to be very terrible to make me call it bad based on the art.
Yeah, good point. If this is the direction that the series goes, Takagi is going to do this story with Shiratori, and now Mashiro is going to be kind of left to his own devices, perhaps trying to be an artist for someone else. Are you satisfied with that? I mean, to me, the thing that makes me most uncomfortable is that the original dream was the three of them, and then I think, if I recall correctly, Kaya kind of got brought into the fold.
Right.
But the original dream was between the three of them, that Ashirogi Muto would create the manga, and eventually it'd be made into an anime, and Azuki would voice the heroine. This does not fulfill that dream.
Yeah, I think we're going to see some more maturity development between the characters. I mean, we've seen their maturity as authors develop, but perhaps we haven't been shown their maturity as people develop as much as it could have, and that could be what this arc is leading us into.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Beelzebub, chapter 77. What happened in this one, Drew?
Beel sung the Flintstones.
Thank you. Moving on.
Nicely. Yeah, I think we saw a whole lot of sort of, I thought, return to form for Beelzebub. A little bit of Oga and Beel walking to school. A little bit of thoughts about the demon that Hilda detected. And then Oga now has groupies along with baby Beel, who has like a fan club and stuff with all the girls in school as a result of the school festival, which was interesting. Sort of reminded me a bit of like the post-school festival in MXO, only more so. And definitely, Beel having a fan club now is great.
That's fantastic.
And Miki is once again shown up being gay for Oga,
yeah,
for lack of a better way to say it.
Oh, that's completely accurate.
And then later on, we see Tojo and Shizuka talking. Apparently, they have a past together. And then on the roof, we see Tojo, Oga, and Izuma, the three who still really have a feud left over. And then their new homeroom teacher just jumps up and kicks them and one-hit three KOs, basically.
Yeah. So, lots to take away from this chapter. Comedy-wise, I thought, really priceless. I mean, Baby BL having a fan club, I absolutely wholeheartedly adore. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, all the students coming out and, like, wanting to, like, hold Baby BL and, like, hey, it's the badass child raiser.
I like this, especially comedy-wise, the interplay between the members of of Aoi's little group, Kunieda Aoi's little group, who are like, you know, oh, don't stare a hole into her ass like that. I mean, just great little comedy moments, but you're right. Return to form, at least in the sense that it was a return to the formula that made
Which
it so
like,
successful originally.
Yeah, sort of school, Oga being a little delinquent, aloof, and like Baby Beel just being Baby Beel, dragging events along with him.
Exactly. And Furuichi, of course, trying to hog some spotlight after having done practically nothing.
Practically nothing. He blocked a ball with his face, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he got like 2 points. They got 2 points while he was in.
Nice. Surely that was all his doing.
Yep.
Yeah, but then the more serious portion of the chapter came in. In fact, there was one little moment where the female member of the Six Horsemen, who are effectively disbanded or don't have power anymore, but the female member of that group or former group calls out to Tojo, calls him Tora, because his name is Hide Tora, calls him Tora, so clearly she must have some kind of a history with him, right?
Yeah, that certainly seems to be the case. I'm not sure why they're bringing this up now. It makes an interesting segue if we're going to see the horsemen teaming up with the Ishiyama delinquents for a future arc, which could be versus the teachers in some capacity, which has its own interesting potential, or it could be just that this one teacher is involved with demons and everybody's going to be in a fight arc now.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, this teacher then...
the one with the Zabub tattoo.
Yeah, super crazy strong, bandana, beard. We know his name, Saotome.
We know Zenjuro. He's a badass.
We know he's a badass, but we don't really know much more than that. I think it's going to take till next week to really start to learn anything concrete about him. Yeah. So in a way, a transitional chapter, but packed with enough comedy at the very least. You know, some moments of action that were interesting, some moments of boys love fandom awkwardness between.
We're funny.
What is
Oga's reaction to that? Like, I think it's just built up for Oga and BL's reaction to that.
Probably.
That is, like, slowly walk away.
Can I go home together with you after school?
Not even just that, but he's like stuttering. He's like pushing his index fingers together and looking down and blushing. I mean, okay.
And being 100% bottom.
Yeah, pretty much.
Can you call me by my first name?
Oh my god. but a transitional chapter, but fun.
Yeah.
Cool. All right, Fairy Tale. Well, we got two chapters this
transitional
week.
Transitional chapters, yes.
All of a sudden, MangaStream has decided, let's just start being caught up on, like, everything. So we have 200 and 201. Fairy Tale chapter 200 was what, really? It was, like, partying at Fairy Tale, which is, like, half of the series at this point. Just shots of them partying. So then, just a bunch of nonsense and hijinks. Then you get to see the Magic Council once again declare that they want Fairy Tail the Guild disbanded. And then some sad-looking emo kid with the power to kill anything that comes, like, near him.
Yeah.
So that chapter, I thought, was actually kind of just lackluster and boring.
Yeah, that chapter wasn't, like, crazy huge to me. It was nice to, like, get back in the guild. I do like the scenes of the guild just partying. They're fun to read to me, and I enjoyed that part. The Magic Council just feels like more Magic Council. When are they ever going to do anything? Until then, they shouldn't show up.
Well, didn't we already have them pretty much in exactly this same scenario already? Like, what was the entire, like, Orashion Seis arc? Weren't they at the beginning of that?
The reason is because they won against the Orashion Seis. That's the only reason they're, like, still okay any capacity.
It's the same thing.
Like, that, the Magic Council did not thrill me once again with their appearance. Maybe they'll actually do something, but until they do, I'll keep my alarm set to 12 p.m.
Yeah. And what about the boy?
Not that much. In Chapter 200, not that much promise there.
Right. Now, Chapter 201 does introduce something that's a lot more exciting, that's guild-centric.
Yeah, a lot more exciting, guild-centric. Like, girls taking baths, of course.
The fan service at the beginning of that chapter.
Yeah, it was kind of a surprise, and not just on the cover page this time.
No.
The real shocker there. And then beyond that, we see all the guys, like, in commotion to be doing a whole lot of work, get more attention. And we get a little bit about Charles' premonition power, which she's starting to develop to spy on guys' perverted conversations.
Yeah.
Which, that was funny. We also get to see that Panther Lily, another cat-featured thing, can be macho for a little while, which I like. If it's not for a long time, at least he can still at least use magic and be relevant in fights, which I like. It's appropriate for Gazeel's cat.
Yeah.
And then we get to the meat of the chapter, which is there's the S-class promotion exam, and a lot of characters we know will be taking part. It'll be on a guild-managed island, and the people who are taking part, it's actually interesting, because I thought Luvia, for example, I thought she was already an S-class mage when she was in Phantom Lord. Is that a guild-centric ranking?
I really couldn't tell you. That's a really good question. We'll look into that, and we'll wrap up that question next week. Or if you guys are, everyone listening, shonenmeme@gmail.com, let us know, because we have no idea.
Yeah.
But I was very surprised at her inclusion.
Yeah, her being included, it's nice, though, because she is actually one of the characters I've liked, and I missed her during the Edelus arc.
Oh my god, yeah.
Yeah, she's an enjoyable character. There's going to be one to pass, and it's probably going to be Natsu, although it might not be. That's, I guess, something I'm not entirely sure about that, and because it is, I'm looking forward to it. And then Charles sees that, like, there's going to be tragedy happening, which is
right.
Basically a given in any arc. It's not going to be just as fun-loving as you would like.
Are you surprised by the number of non-main characters in this exam?
I'm surprised by the number of non-main characters a little bit, but at the same time, Lucy wasn't going to be in it. Gazeel wasn't going to be in it realistically. They couldn't have both Gazeel and Luvia, and of the two, I would rather have Luvia, plus her magic is more useful for a lot of things.
I agree.
And then, like, the other characters that are being included, for the most part, are characters I like interesting characters, like Elfman, at least.
Elfman, so. I'm definitely excited to see. And then there's just some characters I've, frankly, unless I've not paid attention, I've never heard of.
Some people need to be wiped off at the beginning to show how strong whatever catastrophe is approaching is, I guess.
That is true. Do you feel, let's remove the killing boy from the plot for a second. Do you feel that Natsu deserves at this point to move up to S-class? Is it the right time?
I feel like after Oration Sace, like, it would have made more sense before Edelus, because he didn't do a lot during that arc, but mm-hmm. post-Oration Sace arc and everything, I think it makes sense for him to be moving up to S-class around now.
Yeah, I mean, based on his work recently, I guess I just... It feels awkward to me, but on the other hand, I am so ready for the plot to move forward on really key plots, such as looking for his father, looking for the dragon. I mean, I would imagine that he'd have to be S-class at least to go on that quest, yeah, wouldn't you think?
I think it would be a good milestone that would definitely serve to advance the rest of the plot.
And once again, the chapter ends with this mention of this boy who kills anything around him, this time through Charlie's premonition. Thoughts on... I'm not at all excited. The S-class exams are almost always great in Shonen. Exams are a staple. They're always really exciting. I love the format. So that I'm excited for, but this boy, just the unwanted ability to kill anything around him, I've seen that done to death. And he's all emo. He's got, like, the down haircut and the dark clothes. I'm not interested. I'm
not particularly looking forward to an interrupted exam. If it turns out he is the exam, that might work a bit better. But he's the one part I'm not looking forward to this arc for. But I, overall, seeing the reintroduction of characters that I like and non-parallel versions on top of that, I'm definitely really hyped up by this chapter and looking forward to future Fairy Tail.
Oh, can we treat Edelus like we treat Wooly?
Yeah, Panther Wooly just wandered in one day and said, I want to be Gajeel's pet.
The moratorium on
Edelus.
And
Lissana was never dead. She was just, like, training in a casino for a while.
I went to the store for 2 weeks. All right, let's move on now. Hayate no Gotoku, chapter 288, which was a fantastic little comedy chapter in which Nagi is aiming to finally move forward with her dream to become a mangaka. Or at this point, maybe it's not a dream necessarily. This is her plan.
One of her three ways of making money. The other two are which are running the inn and stocks and bonds.
Yeah, great. Which clearly she's so on top of. So yeah, she's getting ready to submit her master work to Sunday, and she's chosen Shonen Sunday because it really is the best of the magazines. No one would want to come to be a newcomer at Jump. It's just too hard on newcomers.
I think you mean JU asterisk P.
I'm sorry, I don't know what magazine they're actually talking about. But yeah, I love the little meta moments there with, you know, oh yeah, Sunday is the best, and they have that clubsunday.jp and all this, like, wow, you really know a lot about Shonen Sunday.
And Nagi's like, plus it's just my favorite because it's the best one.
Somebody's got to sell that magazine.
Yeah, no kidding. So ultimately, the Ashibashi-sensei gets brought back into the fold, who is the... What's the name that they give to his parody series? It's a bunch of things depress this guy or something very basic.
Yeah, I think it's a play on Zetsubou-sensei.
He's obviously supposed to be the guy who does Zetsubou-sensei. I'll load this up as we go. But basically, he agrees to take a look at her work, take a look at her name, to use a Bakuman term.
Yeah.
And that brings about some comedy on its own where they're raising the question, oh, is it okay you're going to have – because Ayumu also wants to go. So is it okay you're going to have two girls coming over to your apartment? Oh, that's okay because I love high school girls. And Hayate, no, pulls him away.
Yeah, Hayate is like hiding both of them, standing in front of them. That was some well-done comedy. And Hayate, if nothing else, I'm never surprised by how good the comedy is because it's just – it's one of the best comedy series running.
I love also the fact that Ayumu has absolutely no idea that this guy was famous and successful all along.
She has no idea that he's like, they start telling her how much he's earning and the kind of place he's living in, and she's all surprised. She had no idea that he was a big deal.
Well, that's what happens to people who don't read manga. They end up uninformed.
Exactly. Here's the exact quote. You've surely completely forgotten about him, but he's the famous mangaka of the hit manga This or That Depresses Me. Really, really funny chapter, frankly. The jokes were pretty fast incoming and really, really funny. And it's actually an interesting setup for next chapter, because this character has kind of just been a very, very minor character. Nagi's manga has just been a punchline most of this time. And now it's actually kind of serving as a decently serious plot. I mean, this, who knows? It could be a 2 or 3 chapter affair, but you know, that's probably the most extensive that we've ever seen the her manga within a manga be used.
Yeah, I mean, probably only a 2 chapter, but it's been good so far, and the comedy should be good through going to his house and him seeing Nagi's manga, which
he's in
for a surprise.
I can't wait for the reaction shot, because Hayate's and Maria's are always so priceless.
Yeah, when Nagi earlier on was asking Hayate, it's a good manga, isn't it? And Hayate's eyes are off to the side. And
well, it's... is it good? Yeah. All right. Yeah, excited for that one. History's Strongest Disciple Kenichi, we again had 2 releases, 398 and 399. 398, most of that, if not all, was the... In fact, okay, it was only most of that, was the fight between Kenichi and Tirowit. What wasn't that was the color pages, which was focusing...
Of Miu's boobs.
Latex-covered nipples, very specifically.
Yeah, not just Miu. It was a very specific part of Miu's anatomy. That, once again, censorship is just gone, apparently.
Not an issue anymore.
Yeah, wow. All right, whatever. And then 399, pardon me, was almost entirely the fight between Agard and Apachai. So, you know, 2 distinct fight chapters. I'll start with 398, the fight between Kenichi and Tirowit. For me, we are back, finally. I mean, last week I was complaining about... We're getting there, but it's not the kind of martial arts interplay, the exchanges that I had been used to seeing that really got me into the series. And within the first 3 pages of actual action, you have Kenichi countering the move which had previously, quote-unquote, killed him with a throw, basically. I loved seeing that.
Yeah, I mean, once Kenichi really got into the fight and he kind of removed the limiter of only Muay Thai and he started switching between all of his martial arts styles, I mean... That's one of the things that Kenichi does so well, and it's so awesome to see in every single fight, him just going between all these different legitimate martial arts.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think definitely watching him combine the martial arts in a way that effectively countered Tirowit's fighting style was nice to watch, and it definitely seems like that fight still could end either way, although ultimately feel Kenichi has to win, but neither side is really showing overwhelming technical superiority, though both of them are really, really good.
It seems that Kenichi, the character, is on the verge of breaking out, because he's been kind of reserved. He's been kind of following what Tirowit is doing. He's been kind of a counter fighter at this point. He's been switching up his style, but it was kind of all leading up to the Ryusui Seiken, or is that how you call it?
Yeah, Ryusui Seiken.
Yeah, thank you. And he used that, and it didn't do anything, because Tirowit just kind of appeared behind him and took him out. And his masters are kind of egging him on. Tirowit's kind of egging him on kind of in an improper way by calling out the name of Shokano. And Kenichi's just gotten so irate at this point that, at least to me, the way that I read the end of the chapter is that he's about to do something. He's about to break out of his shell and just kind of go all out in the offensive, maybe.
He's going to have to show some evolution as a character at this point, because what we've mentioned previously in the show was that per every fight that Kenichi had prior to this, he had learned a move, had some sort of master direct power-up right in the arc before that. And he has had no such training before this.
Right.
So I think what we're going to get to see maybe is kind of him showing a little evolution of his own, improvising some of the moves, combining the styles like he did previously to create things like his zero-point, zero-step punch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think this definitely could be a new synthetic move by Kenichi. Certainly the way the Apachai Agard fight is going points towards that, because Apachai himself is sort of pulling out a new move he learned by training Kenichi.
Right, yeah, and with regards to that fight, the one that takes place in Chapter 399, your thoughts then on Agard versus Apachai and the way that one's playing out? A very different feel, whereas the Tirowit-Kenichi fight was a lot of exchanges of blows. This was very... It was neck wrestling, as they called it. It was very, very connected, involved at all times. What did you make of that fight?
I thought it was interesting. I mean, as someone who's watched MMA quite a bit, I mean, I've seen some Muay Thai fighters, and the clinch itself that they get each other into is very it's a very common like move that you would see from Muay Thai. It's very specific to that fighting style and lends itself well to the throwing of knees and that kind of stuff. And I think their fight has a lot of technical strength to it that he obviously did his research for.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of that fight?
I think the particular thing that stood out to me was Apichai basically developing the Hien, having, like, because he learned to hold back his punches against Kenichi, he could now alter their direction in mid-swing.
Right.
Because of, like, his ability and finesse doing that necessary to train someone. I thought that was a really nice way to actually tie up his comment, that, like, I learned from Kenichi and that's how I'm going to beat you.
Yeah, I thought, I'm still frustrated by how the rest of the chapters that were leading up to this, the fights that were leading up to this, were not of this quality. But this is the kind of quality that I had grown to love and expect from previous Kenichi. I'm right back in the fold at this point.
Yeah, hopefully the next couple chapters with color pages continue the level of quality. It was certainly good seeing an actual fight going on.
400's the last color page chapter, right?
Yeah.
It'd be interesting if they announced something then.
That would be cool. I have to say, from experience with the manga helpers forums and such, usually if there's some kind of an upcoming announcement, we'll kind of know that there will be an announcement maybe 2 weeks ahead of time or so. Not necessarily what that announcement will be, just that there will be one. Haven't heard any word yet. You know, not to say that it couldn't happen, but I know you're kind of quietly pulling for another anime season, aren't you?
Fingers crossed.
All right. Arigo, chapter 35. What happened in this one, Drew?
He hunted werewolves using meat and lightweight boxers.
Is that how you do it?
Sort of. We sort of see that Argo's looking at another crime scene, and he sees that there are no human victims, so maybe the werewolf really is just after meat. So the next thing he does is goes to a boxer's gym, because of course they've got meat there. No, what he really does is he goes to train against a bunch of lightweight boxers who like have really fast punches, and he spars against a bunch of them at once and beats them for training, which is an interesting way to set that up. And then he goes begging for a bunch of money from Coco, Rio, and Seth, who have a variety of very interesting and character-centric reactions. Coco just lends him as much money as he wants. Rio lends him a reasonable amount of money. Seth charges him 10% per day interest. So good. And then he uses it to buy a whole bunch of meat, including entrails and other stuff, and then takes it to a soccer stadium, waits for the werewolf to come, and pulls out a chain, and then they chain their ankles together and have a punching match.
Which, right.
Yeah.
This is
aura.
This was an interesting chapter. There's just so many different places that Arai has drawn from for the good. I'm not calling it derivative. It was good. I really found it interesting. It was just a surprising chapter to see boxing in a soccer stadium and the whole, like, chain together. I mean, that's like a strap match from wrestling. That's like, like that kind of a weird duel. I mean, just so many interesting little tidbits here and there.
Yeah, I think definitely having worked on another series that was kind of pre-written for him really helped with that. I think he gained a lot of experience in a lot of areas, and definitely life experience is showing in this chapter, and I was definitely very impressed by it.
I remember when this little arc began, we were worried about the direction that it could go in the sense that it was not obviously related to Patchman. Now, it still could be. We have no idea at this point. But I do feel that even if it isn't, it's really standing up on its own. The werewolf, the mythology behind the werewolf, the origin story, the putting on of the pelt, exceedingly interesting. And Arago's actions in this entire chapter, this, the way that he's determined to go about, you know, solving this on his own, the way that he's gone to train, beating up all these boxers on his own, which is a very amusing little moment right there, including Colin Barry.
You can't beat me.
The Colin Barry. I mean, just really standing up on its own as an arc, which is something really that must be said is a huge, huge benefit at this point. Huge positive.
For like a 35-chapter series, which Argo is, it's very positive to have this one arc that just is perfectly maybe filler, but it almost doesn't matter because it's good regardless, like irrespectable to the remaining plot.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a fun arc to read and a very interesting one.
And again, like I said, this very well could tie back to Patchman. This could end up being integral to the overall plot, but we have no idea, and it's still exceedingly interesting. We're going to talk about this more and more. I'm intending to get individual reviews of Arago on the site week to week from now on. I'm we really want this series to be more acknowledged than it is. It is absolutely worth your time. And get in on it while it is this early in its publishing life. It's only chapter 35. You know, it's not too much to catch up on.
It's a very, like, it's a one afternoon read, and you really won't regret it. It's fun all the way through.
Absolutely. Toriko, chapter 110, which is essentially, not to simplify it too much, but it is essentially, basically, let's go to Gourmet World. Really.
Yeah, I mean, Toriko just wants to see how hard it is for himself. He doesn't want to deal with all the training that the old man gave him on the list.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. He's not intending to bring Terry. He's not intending to bring Komatsu. He meets up with Sonny, who has gone into the Gourmet World. And Sonny is rather deliberate in hiding certain facts about how that trip went.
Yeah, he got beaten to a pulp, as we see through flashback, but he just tells Toriko that it was all right.
Right. And of course, Toriko is then, you know, foolish enough. Oh, yeah, I knew it would be easier than anyone said. So he's foolhardy and rushes off to do this. So really mostly a setup chapter, honestly, but still an interesting one because of that interplay between Toriko and Sonny. I thought it was there wasn't much made of the relationship between the two of them, but just the exchange between them, the way that Sonny was both too proud to show to Toriko that he had failed, and yet at the same time knew Toriko well enough to understand, like, there's nothing I can say that's going to stop him. Even if I told him that you're going to die, he's just going to go anyway. I might as well encourage him. Just it may have been kind of wordless or a monologue, and it may have been shown just in art over a few panels, but I thought that was a really interesting exchange between the two of them. What is it that you took away from the chapter?
It was mostly a setup chapter. I mean, it's meant to show us that Sonny certainly wasn't at a level capable of surviving this world. He was saved by someone. Maybe this is where we'll meet Zebra coming up. I would love for that to happen.
I wouldn't think Zebra would be at the level yet where he could, like, go into the Gourmet World. Certainly not if Sonny was, but we haven't seen enough of him to really know that for any detail. What I really liked in this chapter is the idea that, well, I don't like Toriko going to the Gourmet World without Komatsu. I just like the general idea of him going way before he's able to do so.
Yeah.
And he's obviously going to get beat somehow, but it's sort of like watching you play an RPG after you, like, deposit all your gold in the bank and just, like, go to fight the Beefgate to see how you're doing. Yeah. And then just get killed.
Yeah, how do you feel about, not that specifically, but how do you feel about him going alone without Komatsu, without Terry, without, I don't know, Rin, maybe? She's been sadly neglected in all of this because she's a woman.
It's a man series.
Yeah. How do you feel about him going there alone without some of these side characters?
I feel like it's going to make the arc itself less interesting, but it shows that, like, on some level, he knows he's going to lose, like, regardless of any of that.
Yeah, I mean, certainly we know that.
Yeah, he's setting himself up for failure and, like, at least hedging safe, so that leaves him a lot of room to lose, and I think that's where this series is heading.
Do you feel that some of these side characters should be going along with him?
I certainly think we have a good enough cast of side characters that we haven't seen, certainly Ren and Terry, who we haven't seen hardly any of, that I'd love to see more of, but I'm still banking on maybe we'll meet some new characters that are going to be main characters through this journey.
Yeah, ultimately, we don't have a huge cast at this point. We have the three of the four Heavenly Kings, and in terms of characters that are really central to the plot, we have, what, Terry, Komatsu, Rin is still
Rin,
kind of
maybe,
on the periphery.
But she's a minor character, but she is, like, a government employee and stuff.
Yeah, there's not very much in our core. I could very well see at least one new main character introduced. Whether or not that's Zebra, who knows? We know so little about him. But, yeah, I mean, I miss Terry, frankly. Having Terry along for the journey was just so much fun. And I like Komatsu. I think he's kind of the best character in the series, at least in terms of relatability. I mean, he's kind of what draws the audience in to this fantastic world. But Terry was just such a fun character, and he's been on the sidelines for so long. I'm a bit disappointed.
Right, I like the idea of an animal that can keep up with the main character.
Yeah.
Yeah. It really, like, when Terry and Komatsu, like, whenever Toriko fails in this arc and Terry and Komatsu both come into the Gourmet World together with him, that's going to be really when this series kicks off again for another huge arc.
Yeah, I think so. This was, again, largely a setup chapter and an enjoyable one, but it, you know, this is not what makes us read Toriko. It was not eating. It was not massive action. So ready for next week, definitely. Maho Sensei Negima, chapter 302. What happened in this one?
This was basically meeting with Dynamis, and Negi's kind of squaring off against him. They're both judging each other's strengths, trading some attacks. And then Dynamis forces the girls out of the magical cloak that was hiding them all, the artifact of one of the other, the ninja girl.
Mm-hmm.
And they are all kind of originally, like, everyone shocked, like, oh, now they're going to be drawn into the battle. And they prove themselves capable of dealing with the minor girl characters that are with Dynamis. They take care of a few of them right off the bat. And that's kind of where we're led into.
Yeah, I really liked showing like how the regular Negi party could actually be of usage in this battle.
Mm-hmm.
Because it sort of has been a running theme that like while Negi has been protecting these girls, like a lot of them really don't need protecting. They got scattered when they first came into this world, and most of them made it out on their own in one way or another. So that it's not like they're weak at all. It's not like Negi is the only strong character.
Yeah.
And they did a really good episode of showing this off, especially Notica. Right, Clint?
Yeah, Notica gets quite a few, for lack of a better term, fuck yeah moments. I mean, she's always the one giving the big impassioned speech to the bad guy. She's always the one charging in against an enemy stronger against herself, and more likely than not prevailing.
Yeah.
She's an all-around good character.
Yeah, I have to agree with what Drew said. It's really nice to see that the growth, the establishment of strength of all these side characters, for lack of a better word, hasn't been forgotten, I guess. You know, they did stand on their own when they were all scattered about the world, and that's shown still. Is Negi using too much power right now?
I don't really feel so. I think this is kind of a way of showing, like, he's using this much, and Meiji Arebia, we know, for the longer he uses, the more power builds up inside of him.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he's just going to get stronger and stronger up until the clash with Fate.
Okay, well, is anything else to really take away from this? I mean, it was kind of just straightforward fighting and...
Yeah, a few, like, small skirmishes kind of on the periphery of big fights that are getting ready to take place. Another Dragonzord.
Dragonzord.
Yeah.
But they even said dragon folk this time.
Dragon yep. folk this time, not demon folk.
Much some, better.
Some stupid little innocent accidental joke some that I made. Some
translation towards Lord. Yeah.
Akamatsu heard about it.
He must have.
He listens to Beamcast. Siren. Let's do Siren. 134. What happened in this?
Well, we saw that Kagetora was taking a whole bunch of swords and really not getting an impact from it, from, like, the guy he dueled in, actually in... I thought that was interesting that they decided to pair him up as an opponent against the guy he fought in the past before, like, and for Kagetora, this is right now, right after that, because he's coming from the past, whereas for this guy, it's been, like, 10, 15, 20 years since yeah. that point. So, or however many years it's been between, like, the end of the world and current Siren.
Mm-hmm.
But we see Kagetora dueling, and, like, despite the fact that 10 years have passed and the other guys had way more time to train, Kagetora is still by far the stronger one.
Yeah, which was fun to read, actually.
Yeah, him just taking lots of hits the samurai mafia way.
Love seeing him in action. He's so the antithesis of really any other character in that series.
Except for Kyle.
Well, if you're just boiling it down to pure awesome, I guess.
Yeah, him and Kyle. Well, they're the physical guys.
Yeah, I guess that's true. He's just... Yeah, Kyle still uses magic to reinforce himself. I mean,
yeah, that's true. Well, he does too. He's also got the the rise.
That's true. Kagetora, he's just, I don't know, he's
just pure physical, but like the pinnacle of pure physical. He's going close to Kazuma, probably.
Yeah, of course.
Is what that means, but yes. And then we also see the fight between Matsuri and Grana, and Grana is definitely confirmed to be more powerful, like what with being grown in a test tube and all, but
right.
we see Matsuri holding her own due to, like, immense experience battling the wise, which was interesting and well illustrated, but not a whole lot beyond that. And meanwhile, we just see Amamiya Ageha rushing towards Moroku, and, like, that fight is about to start, which is somewhat good-looking for the future, but... Nothing really huge in this chapter, I would say.
No, not really. I mean, some interesting, fun moments with Kagetora. The other fight was just kind of, this is, you know, explosion attack, you punch, punch. It was just kind of like trading of blows, really. It didn't really blow me away at all.
Yeah.
And then chasing after Miroku, you know, okay, we know that they're doing that. Just get there at this point.
Just it's got to be the fight next chapter. There's not a whole lot else that needs to be done, really.
No. Nurarihyon no Mago, chapter 122, which we've been kind of concerned about and wondering about, how exactly does this Matoi work? What are the different interpretations of it and all that? So here come Kurotabo and Kubinashi to help out in the fight, and Kurotabo ends up playing quite a large role in this chapter. We see Kidomaru charge at Nura with this, I don't remember the name of the attack, but basically it's just a very fast sword attack for all intents and purposes.
Yeah.
And then he comes at him again as Kurotabo is trying to instruct Rikuo as to this new technique, because he wants him to initiate Matoi in a different fashion of some kind. And it's interrupted by Kidomaru using this new sword slash, which is, I believe he says, 10 times faster than the previous one. And then as he's setting up for this final one, he's, you know, the air around him is going black, and he's going to use this final one, which is 100 times faster. You'll never see it coming. It's going to kill you. Rikuo and Kurotabo, pardon me, are able to fuse in the Matoi. They're able to trigger Matoi. We don't exactly see how they actually trigger it, but unlike the previous Matoi, where Nura kind of just had a new set of powers, he's actually kind of wearing the fear, like literally and figuratively, of Kurotabo, in that he has access to Kurotabo's powers. Like, he's wearing all of the weapons. He has the cloak and everything. So that's going to, I mean, yeah, that will have ramifications in our tier list, but all that kind of stuff aside, I mean, that's an interesting twist, because there are a lot of series out there that make use of the entire I can use everyone else's powers sort of ability. Are you okay with that as a development for Rikuo?
I think so. I think this is what he's working towards. All of his powers are very centrally based around his Hyakkyaku. I mean, they've made such a huge deal, the entire series, of you are as strong as your group of friends, your Hyakkyaku, and they are as strong as you are. Mm-hmm. You reinforce each other. So this fits right along with that, a power-up where he kind of wears the clothes and abilities of one of the members of his Hyakkyaku.
Mm-hmm. So do you see him kind of getting all of the different powers and continuing to use all of the different powers?
Yeah, I think for a while now we're going to have him cycling through people, and I'll be interested to see like how he joins with people or who he was to join with mm-hmm. in his fight against the Gitsune.
Hagorama Gitsune, yeah. One of the things that I found rather interesting, maybe I'm reading too much into this, but Kurotabo, at first he says, you know, I'm so proud to see, you know, your little Rikuo has grown up and he's using Matoi, and it's such an honor. I was a little bit slow, I apologize, because I was just basking in the glory, you know, kind of going on and on. But the little tidbit that he says is, I want to teach you a new way. He was implying that there's more than one way to initiate Matoi, more than one variation of Matoi. And that very well could just be these two that we know, which was the one that he used with Sudara, and now the one that he's used with Kurotabo. But could it be that there are even more ways?
I think there are, I mean, there are obvious possibilities if you wanted to theorize. I mean, he hasn't yet found one that, like, mixes his fear with someone else's. He's kind of been cladding himself within their fear.
Right.
No real mixing. So there's definite possibilities and things that you could think of for other things. And yeah, I did kind of get the feeling that was implied, too, when he said that there are other forms of Matoi that we don't know about still.
Okay. Once again, speculation for the future. Do you think that eventually the triggering of the Matoi will be able to come from, like, the tattoos on his back or something, rather than just having to be, in direct contact, meshing his fear with a member of the Hyakkyaku?
I'm not sure whether it'll take place. I mean, we're certain there's got to be some reason that the tattoos appear, even if it is just to signify that he has joined with that specific person and gain their mark.
Mm-hmm.
But, it might weaken it a little bit if he is able to gain this power completely on his own without relying on his Hyakkyaku. It might ruin a bit of the meaning behind it.
Yeah, because then they wouldn't have to be around. And that is the entire concept that you mentioned of you are only as strong as your Hyakkyaku. Well, if they don't have to be there, then you don't. I mean, yeah, he still has to rely on their support in a power sense, but Yeah, if they're not actually physically there. Yeah, you're right. That would kind of diminish the impact and the meaning of that statement. All right, Zettai Kaden Children, Chapter 230. What happened in this one, Drew?
Well, what we see is, first of all, a lot of them prepping for the festival. And by prepping, I mean just, like, the kids doing a little bit of prep, but then also, at the same time, the chief of Babel getting back into the scene, planning to deploy his A-team to protect the festival and, like, classic chief style, being really overprotective before, like, his subordinates really stop him from getting going. And then they just go to the festival as, like, regular guests, like Minamoto, the chief, Fujiko, and the supervisors. You guys.
Sorry, we absolutely ruined his train of thought because we're watching television and Bleach ads just came on. Anyway, continue.
Yeah, it ruined me too.
We're cheering for marriage here.
But yeah, they're just going. And then we see a little Yo and Sakaki, interestingly enough, because we already knew that Pandora was coming. We see people sort of pairing off with their evil opposites. Yo and Sakaki are both heading to the high school division to do some picking up girls.
Yeah.
Which, so in character there. And then we also see, like, the Yuri's subordinates, Nai and Hanzo, both going to see the play. A little bit of moment with ninja comedy for Hanzo, who just does a bunch of ninja seals and pulls out a program to figure out where the play is taking place.
And has Sharingan.
Not just any Sharingan.
He has Mangekyo, yeah.
So presumably he would go, like, right next to Itachi on the tier list. But then we get to, like, what's really setting up for immediately in the next chapter. Yuri's doing a little bit of final practice on the roof, and then Kagutsu and Kuromaki both show up and appear to be ready to attack her and take her out, which is, if it's true, those two are, like, amazingly outmatched, and it'll also lead to quite a bit of tension and presumably a bit of a fight going on at the festival to begin with. I wasn't expecting something quite this soon.
Right. My big issue with this series, and this chapter is kind of an example of that, is that the comedy moments I find to be great. I really thoroughly enjoy the comedy. But to me, it overshadows the plot. I mean, to me, the plot is just 10 times less interesting than, I mean, the omake page in this one with the Naruto joke, and then the follow-up of that, which after seeing it explicitly in the omake page, I absolutely did not expect it at all to see it in the actual proper chapter. I mean, that stuff I found extremely funny, but then there's just I'm not too into the head of Babel. That's a little bit tired out at this point to me. I'm not at all engaged in the school play. It's just, and then the whole showdown with between the characters at the end of the chapter, I'm not really that engaged in the plot, which, you know, the comedy is good, but to me it's almost as though, you know, he's setting me up a little bit because I'm so into it for a moment and then I'm let down by the rest. Granted, that it entirely could just be bias, you know, genre bias or something, because I know that you happen to be a big fan of the series.
Yeah, I like the plot of the series. I like the way it sort of it showcases character growth through, like, parenting and growing up. I think it's, like, one of the only shonen I read that does that. Like, one of the only series I read, not just, like, within the shonen demographic, that accomplishes that. That said, I can see how some of the plot can get stale, like, relative to some of the comedy, which is, like, if Shina is nothing else, he is a very adept comedy author, and I think Ghost Sweeper Mikami very cleanly showcased that for me. It was a much more comedy-centric series, but that said, I do like the way this series does drama. I can understand, like, how it could possibly get stale. For me, it's been very rich and entertaining, but
good. There
are things there.
As for this chapter, then, I mean, the comedy, I think we both agree, was great. But the serious plot came in mostly at the end. I mean, there was a little hint that that Hyobu might be up to something. But aside from that, I mean, really the meat of the chapter was at the very end of it. You mentioned that you were surprised that the action was going to be coming this soon. Pleasantly surprised? Disappointed?
That was more on the more in the direction of negative surprise. I would expect, like, at least Hyobu being the tactician that he is to, like, bring a little more than just, like, two of his minor subordinates to bear. But
Right. Maybe
he's just underestimating things, though I would not think so. I think there's got to be something more than just those two are going to attack her straight off.
I would think so. That would not be befitting of Hyobu at all.
Yeah, that would be just a dumb plan.
Yeah.
Unless he, like, told his subordinates and they went off on their own. But that doesn't seem like something he'd be doing also.
I don't think so.
So I guess I'll just have to see what happens next chapter, but I'm a little bit worried based on what happened at the very end here.
Good ending. Chapter 50. Toru.
Toru, yeah. He's running back to Yuki's house, and when he gets there, he is told that she went back to Tokyo and don't come to this house anymore. Because evidently Yuki's family knows something or was involved somehow in, like, how she broke up with Toru, mm-hmm. because they're very clearly on her side in this respect and not forcing her to see him again.
Right.
And that definitely lends itself to drama, because they will meet back up in Tokyo. There's no way the drama's not going to go unmilked.
Yeah.
And then, meanwhile, we see the bald, shaved-head friend of Seiji's is actually in a Koshien contender team for some reason.
Yeah, where the hell did that come from?
That was just sort of out of the blue. I don't know where they're going with that one.
That was weird.
And then Seiji gets back to his job, and Onuma makes a very good point. She gets angry when he says, like, is anything bothering you? She goes off on, like, this big crying rant about him being superficially kind while not really understanding how people feel.
Right.
And then fireworks. He just, like, she's depressed about that for a while. Like, he's trying to think about what she means. And then he goes, takes her up to the roof and shows her some fireworks. And then she's like, oh, that's okay now. I'm sorry, I was just in a bad mood. And that, the fireworks thing, what Onuma said made a lot of sense, and I think that really does encapsulate what Seiji's major personality flaw has been.
Completely.
And then just fireworks. Makes me mad just thinking about it.
Why were there fireworks? Why?
No, that's legitimately a thing you can do. If you cheat on a girl or she breaks up with you, show her some fireworks and everything's fine.
Oh, yeah.
That's true. Especially if she's high school age.
Why the hell were there fireworks? There just happened to be fireworks.
Yeah, why not? That's pretty much what I've got to say about this chapter.
This series used to be so good. For a while.
But now it's ending. So it can't be good.
No, seriously. Because
that would be too obvious. With the title.
I absolutely agree that Onuma said what needed to be said. She was completely right in what she said. And yet, I didn't even have a chance to be happy about it, because a couple pages later, freaking fireworks going off, and she completely forgets what she'd been saying and feeling and crying about moments ago.
That's such a missed opportunity for, like,
I know.
For it to have gone this close to everything, and then just, like, to have completely thrown it off by just throwing a random event in here. Let's throw off drama for 10 more chapters and then, like, make it big dramatic again with the romantic four-way going on.
Yeah. So this is really, I mean, I hadn't even really given it too much thought. This actually was a horrible chapter. Toru and fireworks.
Yeah. And this could not have been a whole lot worse, really.
A terrible chapter. Let's move on. Kimi no Minamachi, chapter 105. Basically, this was, it kind of felt rather like the last chapter. There was a lot of, there was a lot of breast comparisons.
Yeah, a lot of more nipples, and there were interesting parts to this chapter. Yeah. Like, plot-wise, there's the fact that Kanzaki showed up again, and she's sort of seems to have, if she hasn't, like, completely abandoned him, her feelings have at least grown to the point where, like, she can talk to him normally and, like, casually, comedically reject any advances he might make.
Yeah.
And there's that, and there's also her, like, even a little bit pushing him towards Asuka, making out the point, if you wait too long, she's not going to feel as much for you either. You might as well grab hold of it.
Yeah, I found that interesting, because it would reinforce the concept that Kanzaki is over him, to some extent, at least. On that point, though, do you think she is now out of it?
I don't feel like she's quite yet out of it, because she was the first real love interest for Haruto.
Right.
Eva aside, she was his original crush, and, like, she came very close to making it a couple of times, so.
Speaking of which, she
is actually one of the more interesting characters of the series. I always did like her more than Eva. If she's still in the picture, it would be interesting.
Regarding Eva, do you think Eva is out of it?
I feel not quite, but I almost feel like the series could benefit to do without her for a while.
I think so. Who do you think is a legitimate chance for final relationship?
Kanzaki? I honestly think,
like, we can just run them down. Kanzaki?
Kanzaki is a chance.
Eba?
Eba is a possibility.
Mishima?
Mishima is a possibility. I think it stops there.
Okay, no Akari.
I don't think Akari is a possibility. No, I think Kiyomi. That's got Takeshi written all over it.
Okay.
And then Kiyomi, probably not. She's been introduced too recently and, like, was on the rebound. Like, So.
And what about Negoshi?
Gonna go no.
I think so. It's too bad. I like Negoshi. She's great. She's just this little side character.
If it had to end in three chapters, might just do a Negoshi end to like make the editors who canceled him mad. But that's the only reason I could see that happening.
Oh, she's great though. She's so funny.
For like two pages, she's great. It's the same way you shouldn't make a movie out of like Evan from Bruce Almighty.
I can't believe you referenced that. And then the rest of this chapter, again, shocking lack of censorship. But I'd have to say I agree with you. I don't think Kanzaki is completely out of it, and I'm okay with that, actually. Yeah, she's one of the more interesting love interests in this
one. She's an interesting character. Definitely, we've already seen a little bit of growth out of her. Looking forward to staying in the hometown for a few more chapters with less hot springs.
With fewer, yeah, definitely. All right, and finally this week, Enigma Chapter 1, a brand new Shonen Jump mystery series. And CXC scans have scanned the first chapter. We certainly hope that they will continue to scan the series because we want to stay current on everything that we possibly can. So let's just get it out of the way. We'll assume that you have all read it because we are going to spoil. Is this series just Mirai Nikki plus Gantz?
It comes really close to being that.
It's derivative of both elements, definitely. Like, there are some individual twists that the author is putting in, and there is potential for goodness there, but it is really drawing its two biggest premises very heavily from directly from Mirai Nikki and directly from Gantz, except that they aren't dead, they're just traumatized when they were brought to it.
Well,
so there are minor differences, but yes, like, the feel is almost exactly the same.
So it's
short of two light novels, I can't think of this much plagiarism happening in one chapter.
It's what, then? It's not Mirai Nikki plus Gantz, it's Mirai Nikki plus Cube?
What?
Because they're not dead, they were just unconscious and woke up there or something?
I guess, if... I don't get the reference, but I guess, yes.
Cube is a film. I hope that someone laughed at that. that's honestly okay. For anyone who doesn't get the joke or the comparison, I should say, Mirai Nikki, because the main character has a diary that predicts the future, a future diary, a Mirai Nikki, one could say.
It's almost like it's a pun.
And then Gantz, because the seven protagonists are just mysteriously at a school in a gym, right?
Yeah, the only difference is there's not a naked girl and a dog.
They can't get out.
The only difference is
no, there is another difference, and it's pretty significant. There's not a panda.
Oh.
No panda.
Damn.
Yep.
No, I mean, they wake up, and they've been mysteriously transported to this school gym where they can't get out. They're locked in, and they have no cell phone reception, and then this mysterious... We're just going to call it Enigma. It's two backwards E's. We don't know if it's supposed to be like Enigma or something else. We're going to call it Enigma. It's the symbol is a skull with the jawbone backwards. So the jaw faces the other way, which actually is kind of an interesting piece of imagery, honestly. I think that's a pretty good design.
It's fairly creepy like it's supposed to be.
For like a murder mystery type thing. That makes sense well enough.
One thing I didn't like with this... was right off the bat, the instructions Enigma gave were find any way you can to get out of the school, and then a couple pages later, the exit is on the roof of Building 3.
Yeah. What?
Yeah, that seemed to me to be... That was incoherent. Like, it's like you're supposed to find a way out of the school despite it being a locked room. Like, that is interesting. If it's just like... hunt down riddles and find them. That's like a school festival game. That's right. Not anything particular.
Yeah, and like it just said there will be shadows in the halls, which, you know, that's more acceptable. I mean, obviously there's going to be some kind of force stopping them from just going everywhere and getting everything.
Right.
What I hope is that it doesn't immediately turn into a versus thing, so I can't, like, I don't want to accuse it of ripping off Liar Game as well, but I may have to do so.
What do you think about our cast of characters here? Let's start with the protagonist. I've made some comments about, you know, character designs ripping off certain other characters, but just in terms of the character overall, acceptable?
He's an all right character. He doesn't have a whole lot of personality just yet.
Yeah.
Nor do most characters in Chapter 1. I feel like he's at least got the whole flirting thing going for him. He's not he's not really a bad protagonist right off the bat. It's not like he just wants to take somebody's picture while wearing an eye patch.
That brings me to another point, actually. Thank you. How do you feel about this as a Shonen Jump series? Are we okay with this publishing?
I would be more okay with this than any other canceled series that I've seen thus far this year being published as an extended series, if it fulfills the promise that, like, it's at least looking to be, like, a decent mystery series. That's what the hint I get out of this chapter. If it lives up to that, I don't mind. It has to do so, though.
Right. What do you think?
It is roughly 1,000 times better than SWAT.
Only 1,000.
Perhaps more.
Maybe 9.
Oh, we won't go there.
Yeah, SWAT is putrid. So glad we don't have to cover it this week. Yeah, my biggest issue with Shonen Jump is that, honestly, there hasn't been, in my opinion, granted, there has not been a series as good as Akaboshi since Akaboshi was canceled. And that's the frustrating thing. I understand some series, given their format, given their table of contents and fan voting, some series ultimately have to be canceled. Something has to be near the bottom. Something has to be less liked than everything else. I get that. And in doing so, they are always going to give new artists a chance. And that's actually fantastic. But to cancel a series that had such great promise, Akaboshi, for those of you who haven't read it, it's a retelling of the Suikoden story, the 108 Stars of Destiny. For those of you who have played the video games, you know exactly what I'm talking about. For those of you who don't, go read a book. I'm not going to get into it. It's very long-winded. It's all Chinese and stuff. But it's very interesting. The art of Akaboshi was absolutely fantastic. The plot, you know that there's a built-in long-term plot because it's an adaptation of Suikoden, the folklore story Suikoden. So, I mean, if you have to run off collecting 108 characters, you know that they have long-term plot built up. So, to me, that series was really set up to do rather well. It canceled, if I recall correctly, at about 26 chapters. It's been a while. And everything that's followed it has just been so completely lackluster, especially this year. I mean, my Lock On was just unimaginative. Yotsuya was just neuro but bad. I mean, what else have we had? Shonen Shiku has been
Metallica, which was, like, a little bit more than generic, but really not much.
Metallica was, for me, like, the epitome of generic. It wasn't doing anything bad, but that's because it was firmly sticking to every trope that you would expect of Shonen. Yeah. I mean, right off the bat, they had an exam arc.
Yeah.
Yeah.
SWAT, which we've shared our opinions on that one. Omagadoki Dobutsuen, which the scans are behind, so we haven't had the chance to cover it. Red Hawk, I think it is slowly getting caught up. If they catch up on that, we'll definitely talk about it. Very original premise. I've read the one-shot. I've not read the series.
I've read the one-shot in some of the series. The one-shot was great.
Yeah.
The series has kind of failed to deliver on the exact same premise of the one-shot.
Okay. That's pretty much it. What's the last series I remember being good for a short-run series? Anedoki, really.
Yeah.
In Shonen Jump. Going back to Enigma, sorry that we kind of got way off track there, but going back to Enigma, is it the best series since Akaboshi? From one chapter? Maybe it is. It very well might be that or Anedoki.
It seems like, right off the bat to me, it's one of those series that has the potential, at least, to do well in Jump, whereas I might not have felt that so much with Lock On or with Metallica.
My problem is mainly just the comparison that we made at the very beginning of this segment. If it's so derivative of two series, just blatantly derivative, I have a hard time supporting it. I have a hard time reconciling that fact with my enjoyment of it. I don't know. Hopefully it will distance itself a little bit more, but quite obviously the Future Diary and the being at the command and at the whim of this strange enigma being voice, what have you, those are obviously the two main plot elements. You can't exactly detach yourself from them, so I don't know. So, good, bad, what are your thoughts on it overall and promise going forward?
I think it's done about as much derivation as it's allowed to do. Like I said, if it starts, like, ripping off Liar Game, which would seem to be a likely target to be next, if it starts doing more derivative stuff, I think we can count it out in any perspective as far as it being good. But it's still got a chance at this point.
Yeah, if I see any Death Note pulling or any other type of series it pulling from, I would be inclined to be against it, but so far it has some amount of promise. It just needs to do its own thing.
Right. Okay, time now for the series that we individually read, and Clint has Dead Man Wonderland, Chapter 38.
For all intents and purposes, this series seems to be drawing close to its end. We see that the director of Dead Man Wonderland has been cornered, and he thinks he has a military contact coming up for this, but he really doesn't at all. And they've captured the helicopter. They seem to have him down, but in a surprising twist at the end, the Wretched Egg shows up, and she's really like, we wonder what's going to happen with that. I mean, she's kind of a third party between these two warring parties of rebellion and the established order of Dead Man Wonderland. But there wasn't a whole lot of actual content in this chapter, mainly a lot of setup and posturing.
Okay. And now for the series that I read, beginning with Air Gear Chapter 287, which was very much just a lot of setup for various different fights, and Ikki kind of getting everyone back on track after his brand new regalia were just broken last chapter, which, although last chapter was about 6 or 7 weeks ago after another hiatus, of course. He's gotten everyone back on track. They're going to go around collecting the parts that are on the battleship to be able to rebuild his regalia, which he obviously needs to be able to defeat the Lightning King who's there. But other than that, it's pretty much just set up for a bunch of upcoming fights. Chapter 104 of Codebreaker, essentially Ogami Rei seals Yuki's power with this bizarre new power of his, the second flame. Which has the power to burn away the seven deadly sins. This all of a sudden within the last two chapters, this has gotten a lot more supernatural. It's able to almost entirely suppress and or contain Yuki's sound manipulation power because of the way he was using it, the sins that he carried while using it. It's just a really bizarre piece of imagery there, I suppose, is the way of putting it. But at the end of the chapter, Yuki takes some kind of a pill that he had in his collar, so we don't exactly know what that's going to do, but I guess this is like the last ace up his sleeve. It was a decent chapter, just kind of confusing with the supernatural stuff that's going on. Defense Devil Chapter 64, almost entirely setting up to save Ida Maria by having the person who's tagging along with them shoot out the lights. Kookaburra was under a lot of criticism in this chapter for not just rushing right in and trying to save her blatantly. He instead theorizes that the best course of action at this point is to shoot out the lights, make the entire place go dark, and then, hey, he's a little bit more tactical in his approach to this. It was an interesting chapter from that regard, but there really wasn't that much to it. I think it's really going to start to pick up in next chapter when he's actually trying to save Ida Maria from this devil soccer game with a giant stone cross, of course. And finally, Katakoshi Hitman Reborn, Chapter 306, is a continuation of the fight between Ryohei and Aoba. And Aoba was holding back with these pitch-black sunglasses because he has the ability to see the killer spot, which is not at all like pressure points in Fist of the North Star, except that it's exactly like pressure points in Fist of the North Star, where he can see exactly where to target his opponent and hit them where it'll cause the most damage. It's just Fist of the North Star. They even come out and say it's like pressure points, but not. But then it just is. But then he was obviously suppressing his own incredible vision for his own safety, because shortly after using this, he begins to suffer some kind of damage from overuse, I suppose, and Ryohei is able to capitalize on that and strike back. I will say the only positive in this chapter is that Ryohei's counter technique wasn't just another ace up the sleeve sort of attack. It was actually analyzing his opponent and striking back when he's discovered the weakness. I will give Amano that. At least it wasn't just a linear power up. That said, this series has lost the plot. I am very, very disappointed, and frankly, the less we cover on this series, the better. So it is now time for Chapters of the Week. Clint.
My chapter of the week was Dead Man Wonderland 38. Even though most of it was set up, it was good to see that the Wretched Egg is still moving. You kind of wonder what's going on with Director Tamaki, how he's going to get out of this. He certainly doesn't seem like the type of guy that's this easy to take down. And I'm really looking forward to the conclusion of the series playing out. It seems like we're close.
Drew.
I really liked Fairy Tale 201, and it's going to be my chapter of the week because I got to see a lot of the characters that I really enjoy from the series again, and we're looking at a more Guild and Earthland-centric arc. Which, what else would Fairy Tail feature but Earthland? It's only been taking place in Earthland, so why not?
Exactly. and for me, the chapter of the week was Kudanai Chapter 34. Admittedly, it wasn't that extravagant of a week for chapters. They were all rather unexceptional. Good, but not really a standout. Kudanai, I'd have to say, is the one chapter this week that came out that was good without any reservation, good without any sense of disappointment. And it's not as though it only wins it by default. It was a rather interesting chapter. Well, the cut aside, some very interesting plots, some very interesting character interaction. So that's my pick of the week. We'd like to thank you very much for tuning in again. Unfortunately, due to personal reasons, we will not have a show next week, but we will come back the following week better than ever. We got some interesting and fun features we want to share with you guys. So thank you very much for tuning in. Check back with us in 2 weeks. Final Flash.
You are tired from the long trip. It would be best if you went to bed early today.
You're 100 years too early to hear my Final Flash.
Damn it. Phil Dowd, try reading the rule book sometime. You don't know what you're doing. Thanks very much for listening. Good night.